Support for Boston Public Radio comes from the Museum of Science, where you can experience the heart of New England, their new giant screen film showcasing this iconic region. You can see it now on the IMAX Dome screen. Tickets at mos.org. And Safety Insurance, offering a variety of home insurance products to cover your home's increased value. You can ask an independent agent about Safety Insurance. Safety Insurance. We'll help you manage life's storms.
Ahead on Boston Public Radio, live from our GBH studio at the Boston Public Library. In February, Bill Weld said he wanted to debate Trump as one large orange man to another. Now that he's running for president, will his dream come true? We'll open the lines and ask if Weld is a welcome alternative to Donald Trump, or could he help get him reelected? Then it was one of the most suspenseful marathons in decades, with the men's race truly being one to the finish. Sports Authority Trina Kuznarek joins us to recap marathon first. Then at noon, Boston City Councilor Andrea Campbell is here for her take on whether rent control will have a second act in Boston.
Food writer Corby Kummer is here to talk about the diets of the rich and famous. Twitter CEO Jack Dorsey is practically starving himself to death, but he calls it biohacking. And Oprah Winfrey simplifies her grocery shopping by cutting out the middleman and just buying an avocado orchard. That's next on Boston Public Radio. I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. It's Tuesday, the day after the Boston Marathon. We were here yesterday, too. It was very exciting.
It was pretty exciting.
And we're back, as we are every Tuesday, at the studio at the Boston Public Library. Hello, Jim.
You know what's interesting? I got here early this morning, of course, much earlier than you, is typically the case. And all signs of the marathon are gone, except you see across Boylston Street this huge line. What's your speculation as to what's going on?
I think it's got something to do with getting either your name on your medal or your time on your medal or something
like
that.
Half the people have the marathon runners' jackets on.
Yeah, they're there with their medals to get them authenticated or something close to that.
You know,
if we were real investigative reporters, Jimmy would have found that out.
Well, I tried to send one of our viewers or listeners over, but they refused to go. You know, I want to say that I occasionally criticize Marjorie for lack of, self-restraint.
Uh-huh.
But the fact that it is now 11:07 and you're waiting till 12:30 to discuss the Globe story on pensions at the T is really, you deserve great praise for that, and I want to be the first one.
Dozens retiring in their 40s.
At 12:30.
Beautiful thing, Jim.
At 12:30, we will discuss Marjorie's favorite story, maybe of the decade, with you.
Well, think of that when next time you're on the red line that catches on fire. Think of that one of the reasons they have money problems.
Well, you can't blame them because almost all the workers are retired, so it's not really an issue. You can't blame them for what's happening. In any case, you got to wait till 12:30 for that. Because, you know, we all thought that among the former governors of Massachusetts, the one who'd be running for president would be Deval Patrick. But instead, as you probably know, it's Bill Weld.
I'm announcing that I'm running for president of the United States as a Republican against President Trump in 2020.
That was Bill Weld on CNN's Jake Tapper yesterday, announcing on CNN. And last month, when Weld was still in an exploratory mode in New Hampshire, here's how he pitched his candidacy. This is a great line to WBUR's Anthony Brooks.
You know, between two men who have nothing in common other than being large orange men, politically, the president and I have not very much in common at all. That might be an appealing way to cast a vote that would make a difference.
So we're taking your calls asking you, is Weld the new orange? 877-301-8970. All you Republicans and independents who can vote, for example, New Hampshire, you can vote in either primary you choose. Is Weld a welcome alternative? Democrats, are you afraid that Weld could peel off another independent vote to get Trump reelected? 877-301-8970. I have to say, good for him. To enter a prime, it doesn't matter whether you like Trump or not. I love competition. I think it is great for politics, great for government, ultimately for someone to be challenged. And to challenge a guy, what are his approval ratings in the Republican Party? 85% to 90%.
Oh, huge.
Donald Trump.
Huge.
For Bill Weld, who's been out of politics, what, a quarter of a century, basically, I think?
Well, he just ran as a libertarian. What are you talking about?
Well, I meant elected office. My apologies. He did run as a libertarian vice president, even though he did endorse Hillary Clinton. It appeared when he was running with Gary Johnson for president of the Libertarian ticket. So what do you think of our former governor challenging Donald Trump in a primary? There are a lot of Republicans who do want to see Trump challenged, whose preference is this guy Hogan, who I think is the number two most popular Republican governor after
Charlie Baker, yeah,
and John Kasich from Ohio,
Maryland.
Who ran last time. Right, Hogan's from Maryland, or Bob Corker, the guy who was, remember, infamously said as head of the Foreign Relations Committee, "The generals we thought are what stood between us and chaos." How wrong he was.
Yeah, he left. He stopped. He's from Tennessee, and he didn't run again.
So this discussion is not limited to Republicans or Republican primary voters. What do you think of a Bill Weld candidacy? I have to say, for people who are new to Massachusetts, who are too young to remember Weld's governorship, he is one of the wittiest, smartest people I've ever
He's very clever.
Government. He really is smart. He's not an in-the-weeds guy like his mentee, obviously, Charlie Baker is. He's more sort of a, I wouldn't say visionary, sort of a step-back kind of character.
Big picture.
But he is really, really smart and really clever.
I'll never forget a million years ago when he was running for governor in the primary, and he was not doing very well when he was running for governor in the primary.
1990.
There were other people that were supposed to beat him.
Steve Pierce.
Yes, Steve Pierce. And there was someone else, a third person, I forget, who was running against him. He wasn't supposed to win. And I remember driving down the Cape and seeing Bill Weld standing on the rotary there by the Sagamore Bridge, you know, all by himself with his sign and stuff. I'm thinking, poor guy, you know, he's out here all by himself, you know. Nobody's really stopping. Maybe an occasional horn will toot. And then just a couple of months later, he gets the nomination. He was a very popular governor, very fiscally conservative. Lots of people did not like that. Big tax cutting guy. He was bashing welfare when he ran against John Kerry. He kind of got caught up in that meanness thing.
He ran for the Senate in 94,
Did not do well when he did that. But when he was the governor, he was very popular. He's a social liberal. And he officiated at the wedding of his roommate in college, who was a gay guy who became
head
a judge.
Of the Department of Revenue, wasn't he before he became a judge?
Yes, he appeared on the cover of The Advocate, which is a gay magazine. This is much before gay rights were ascendant as they are now, kind of when things were just being able to pick up speed. So he's like Baker. He's a fiscal conservative and a social liberal, but he's just got a different style than Baker. Baker was a protege of his.
Oh, of course he was. You know, I can't remember the guy's name. You mentioned that Weld was way behind. There was a guy running a ballot question the same year in 1990.
That was you,
it was me, that's right. And I bumped into candidate Weld in 1990 in the halls of the State House. I don't think I'd met him at that point, and he shook my hand, and he says, "Loser meet loser," was what he said, because he was supposed to get croaked, and so were we. We happened to win that ballot question, and he won the governorship.
See, the thing,
against,
I mean,
John, you know, that was the infamous John Silber case.
That's right.
And one of the great headlines ever in the Boston Herald, if I remember correctly, was your story. Remember the headline? The person who was nominated to be his running mate, his good friend of mine, former state rep, Marjorie
Clapper,
former talk radio person, former state rep.
Yeah, she was a very sexy looking woman. She'd be up at the, she had the, you know, kind of the Farrah Fawcett hair. She wore high heels, very fitted skirts.
Really good smart, looking, really good talking.
Yeah, but the reason I mentioned she was a very sexy woman, because the headline was perfect. It was Dr. Doom and va-va-va-voom.
That was the headline.
His running mate.
In the Herald.
So that was
That's
pretty good.
True.
But anyway, the thing about, to get back to Weld running, I mean, Republicans are fairly united behind President Trump, except you saw in the 2018 elections, a lot of suburban Republican, particularly women, did not moved away from the Republican Party. And, you know, I don't think a challenger is going to get the nomination, but they could make life difficult for him. They could challenge him in a lot of things. Bill Weld is very smart. I don't think he'd take a lot of guff from Donald Trump. I don't know if there would ever actually be a debate. But, you know, it's a
story.
Would
you ever debate him if you were Donald Trump?
No, because I'd be afraid of debating him.
So would I.
And he's, you know, he made fun of them being two big orange guys, and Bill Weld is a big orange guy. He's got red hair on the top of his head. But, you know, is this Washington Post...
For most people out there, yeah.
That's true. Is one of this Washington Post story points out that it was not easy when Bush faced competition from Patrick Buchanan back in 1992. That hurt him. I mean, people running against the sitting president in their own party hurts them. And I don't know how much it would hurt him, but it would hurt him a little bit. They also point out that Gerald Ford faced a challenge from Ronald Reagan in 76, and of course Ford went on to lose to Jimmy Carter. So
Ford was not nearly as popular in his own party as Donald Trump is in his own party. It's like sort of apples and oranges.
No,
kind
but
of thing.
But I think that there are certain numbers of Republicans who, obviously, as we saw from the 2018 election, would rather vote for somebody else.
You know, there's also, I mean, you touched on this point a minute ago. It's not just Trump's popularity in his own party. It's also, as you described, Bill Weld's politics, not exactly 2019 kind of Republican politics. That's what Jake Tapper asked him on CNN yesterday. He asked former Governor Weld if his brand, meaning Weld's brand of Republicanism, is out of place this year. Here's his answer.
You are a Republican from a different era in American history. You are a moderate Republican. You were the Massachusetts governor. You were able to work with Democrats. You represent a sort of
precisely
country club Republicanism.
No. A Republican who works across the aisle and gets things done. I was reelected with 71% of the vote because I brought everybody in. I would have a bipartisan cabinet if I get to 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. And, you know, I'm an economic conservative. I was voted the most fiscally conservative governor in the United States by the Wall Street Journal and the Cato Institute. I cut spending year over year. Donald Trump is not an economic conservative. He doesn't even pretend to be.
You know, I said in the intro, I'm sorry, what?
You know, it's funny that Jake Tapper would call Bill Weld a country club Republican. I mean, how many country clubs does President Trump own and belong to and spend his weekends at? We've never had a bigger country club Republican than Donald Trump.
You know, I mentioned before we get to your calls, I mentioned at the open that if you were a betting person, you probably would have bet on Deval Patrick being a candidate, a former governor, before Bill Weld. Someone sent me a speech that Deval Patrick gave last week. I don't even know about it, to the Democratic caucus. It was a retreat. That's the one where, I'm sure you read, John Legend and his wife, Krista Teigen, went and did a little thing. It was one of the most beautiful speeches. I mean, the guy can, I didn't hear him, I just read it. It was really incredibly beautiful. But he is not a candidate, will not be a candidate, and Bill Weld, as of Sunday, apparently is.
Well, some of the things Weld said that, you know, that he is definitely opposed to the president's views on climate change. I think climate change is going to be a bigger issue. Certainly it hasn't been an issue at all in previous presidential elections. I think it is going to be an issue this year because of all the terrible things we've seen happening all around the country in terms of climate change.
By the way, on that note, before you continue, Bill McKibben, who started the whole movement 20-some years ago, is with us tomorrow. He's got a new book, so I would stick around for that.
And he's also going after Trump, as the Post points out, a fierce critic of Trump's nationalism, calls it an outgrowth of movements of hate groups. He told the New Yorker that Trump uses, quote, a dog whistle loud and clear to win support from white supremacists and other hate groups.
Well, yeah, I mean, one of the issues is what will the media do with Bill Weld? The only way, he needs oxygen, as they say. He needs time. Got to announce on a Sunday afternoon on Sunday morning, whatever Jake Tapper's show is on CNN, suggests you don't have a forum.
Well, you know, New Hampshire's early, and, you know, New Hampshire may be all behind Trump and the Republican Party now, but I don't know. There may be some goodwill for Bill Weld, who was a very popular governor here
it was 25 years ago, too.
877 But, Jim, there's a lot of old voters. We know that, right?
301-8970. Let's start with Ed in Worcester. You were first on Boston Public Radio. Thanks much for calling. Hi.
Hi, guys. He's a great personality, and I approve of his fiscal conservatism, but other than that, I think he's in the wrong party nowadays. I heard him, I think it was on your station, being interviewed by David Remnick about 3 weeks ago and I missed the first couple of minutes. But the interview went on for, like, you know, 10 minutes. And at the end of it, I thought to myself, did those two disagree about anything? Because if they did, I sure didn't hear.
Well, I can give you one in light of the fact that I was on the losing side of every single, I ran a tax reform group, of every single tax cut that Bill Weld proposed. He cut taxes, if I remember correctly, 41 times.
Oh, I think it was
41. Whatever it was a huge number of times. And that, Ed, is not exact. Maybe socially he's more a Democrat than he is a Republican, but fiscally, as Marjorie said before, he is a rocked rib Republican, a real Republican, opposed to Donald Trump.
The Republicans have really changed. I mean, the Republicans used to be the planet, party of environmental concerns. They kind of threw that out completely. I mean, they've changed a lot, too. They never used to be so tight with the NRA.
Well, I mean, both parties have changed. The Democrats used to be the party of segregation. I mean, he's running in 2020. If he's running as a Republican in 2020, he's got to take some account of what the Republican Party is now. And I haven't heard him opine on the Trump tax cut yet. I haven't heard him say one way or the other whether he thinks that's a good idea.
That's a very good point. Can someone, one of our producers just told us he did this morning comment on it. We'll get that for you, Ed, as soon as we can. Thank you very much for your call. We appreciate it.
Let's go to Kathy in Salem. Hi, Kathy.
Hi, good morning, Marjorie and Jim.
Hi.
I'm sort of on the fence about Governor Weld because he bailed on Massachusetts, and that, to me that speaks to his integrity. Is he better than Trump? Absolutely, pretty much everybody is. I don't know which way I would vote. I'd have to see all the candidates and hear what they have to say and what their plans are and who's the most prepared. But it really bothered me when Governor Weld left before his term was over.
By the way, we should explain what happened.
Yeah.
Bill Clinton nominated him to be the ambassador to Mexico. And what was his name? It was Jesse Helms was the senator who I think was chair of the Foreign Relations Committee or a very conservative senator who didn't like Well, I think most people knew it was a long shot, and I think your point is a good one, because, Marjorie, I hope this is not revisionist history. Most people thought it wasn't going to happen. It was a quixotic thing because he wanted to get out of town. He was bored. Didn't he run or at least contemplate running for governor of New York for a while?
Yep.
He did, right?
Yep.
And obviously he ran as a libertarian, and then when it was clear that Gary Johnson had no idea what planet he was on, remember he went and vouched for the credibility of the Democratic nominee, Hillary Clinton. He served, by the way, on the Judiciary Committee, if I remember correctly, with Hillary Clinton during Watergate. They became friends during that.
And he was, of course,
number three guy. Well, he was a U.S. attorney and number three guy in the Justice Department, as a matter of fact.
Yeah, he was the U.S. attorney here in Massachusetts.
By the way, this is interesting. One of our coworkers just typed that, I don't know if it was on Jake Tapper yesterday, but he Weld compared Trump's immigration policy to Nazism. And on Saturday, I missed this, Trump dismissed that criticism. And here's what he said about Weld. I don't talk about his alcoholism, so why would he talk about my foolishly perceived fascism? I'm sorry. This is from a couple of years ago. It was not from Jake Tapper. I mean, there's a joke around town. Again, if you're new to town, amber-colored liquid. was what Bill Weld was often seen sipping. I have no idea about whether he was an alcoholic or not. I haven't heard that. But he liked amber colored liquor.
Kathy, before you go, are you a Republican?
Independent.
So would you like to see, as an independent, some more people join the Republican primaries?
Yes.
Yeah, you would. Because you're leaning toward the Republican ticket, but you're not happy with the president?
I'm actually not leaning. Anybody but Trump, pretty much.
Yeah, anybody but Trump.
Okay. I tend to vote Democrat, but I have voted many times for Republican as well, and even independent. So.
Yeah.
Kathy, thanks for the call. You know what's really interesting? I don't know if this is a point you're trying to make before. Will independents in New Hampshire who would ordinarily vote in a Democratic primary choose to vote in a Republican party, assuming that Weld makes it that far, or another one of the governors or some other Republican chooses to run, basically to make it clear, as Kathy just said, that Trump is not our kind of guy?
Well,
you know?
Like I said, it's very possible, and there may be, you know, a lot of people that remember Weld when he was the governor here and liked him as the governor here. I mean, it's obviously a protest kind of thing. I don't think anybody thinks he's going to get the nomination. I mean, Trump is going to get the nomination, I think we would mostly assume, but it's a protest against the kind of party that the Republican Party has become under Trump, and the previous call talked about the Democrats being the party of segregation. I don't know that we would say that the Republican Party at this moment has been a stalwart for minority rights with the voter suppression going on all around the country in states like North Carolina, which has just brought it to a really horrifying level. Anyway,
877-301-8970 is our number. We're talking about the candidacy as of yesterday made official by Bill Weld running in the Republican primary against the President of the United States.
We have somebody on the phone from New Hampshire. Harriet. Hi, Harriet.
Hello, Harriet.
So I think you kind of almost made my point. I'm like a never, ever, ever, ever Trumper. Never, never. So I have this idea of it's awful. It would really be exploiting Bill Weld. But if everybody who can't stand Donald Trump, regardless of party, would vote in the Republican primary for Bill Weld, then Donald Trump wouldn't be on the ballot anymore. And then we wouldn't have to deal with him in the election.
Well, what do you say to that Democrat or independent who is concerned? How many Democrats are there now? 19, whatever there are. What do you say to that Democrat who says, I love your concept, Harriet, but I also would like to ensure that the strongest Democrat is the nominee of my party or if you're an independent of the Democratic Party. What do you say to that person?
All I can say is I know that's the glitch. I haven't gotten this concept to it.
Can you, when you figure out that glitch, can you call us back and tell us?
You know, maybe in New Hampshire, it could work because it's one of the earliest primaries, right?
Well, not one of the earliest primaries. It will be the earliest.
I thought there was fighting about it.
No,
established now.
No, the issue. No, it is always going to be
Iowa,
first.
It's going to be first.
The issue is because California has moved up, I think, from June to March. Gardner, I think that's his name, was the Secretary of State for New Hampshire, says that, at least said recently, that the primary could be as early as December.
Okay.
Because not only do they want to go first, but their fear is, which I appreciate, if they're too close to California, that none of the candidates are going to come out here because of how vote-rich California is going to be. So I would bet that as early as January is going to be a primary
so
in New Hampshire.
So if people in New Hampshire made a statement, I mean, that could be possible. You know, people that come out of New Hampshire doing well.
Do you think in the first primary that people who are Democrats are going to unenroll from the Democratic Party and become independents so they can vote against Donald Trump?
I think Republicans in New Hampshire might do it.
Republicans in New Hampshire have 85% to 90% support for Donald Trump.
Well, we don't know what's going to happen between now and December.
We don't?
No. I mean, there's no other Republican to choose from, right?
Mm. Well, there is. Bill Weld, is that your point?
Well, there's Bill Weld, and maybe this guy Hogan. I mean, I can't. It's hard to believe that with all the shenanigans going on and all the.
It's really affected his popularity with the Republican Party.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean,
you know what I think the issue is. I haven't thought a lot about this. Mm-hmm. I think the issue, if Weld is going to mount a serious candidacy against Donald Trump, I think the only issue where he's vulnerable is the pensions for MBTA retiree. Oh, no, that's you who is obsessed. I'm sorry. I got the wrong race kind
of
thing.
We're talking about Bill Weld running against Donald Trump. One large orange man against the other. Did the presidential election just get more interesting? The conversation continues on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio, live from the WGBH studio at the Boston Public Library.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. We're live from our GBH studio at the Boston Public Library. That line is really long.
I know.
It's longer than the race. It's just unbelievable.
Yeah.
We think that people are waiting for their medals. We have no idea what's going on over there.
We don't.
If you're just tuning in, we're talking about Governor Bill Weld. You probably know that he announced yesterday on Jake Tapper on CNN. He is running against Donald Trump. We're taking your calls asking you, is this good for the GOP, bad for the Democrats, or is it bad for the GOP? Massachusetts, are you excited to have two of our political leaders running for office? Obviously not Deval Patrick, but Elizabeth Warren. 877-301-897. You know what's interesting is that Charlie Baker, to my knowledge, correct me if I'm wrong, has not endorsed his mentor.
No.
I think he said he's staying out of presidential politics and is going to focus on running Massachusetts. But he is in an odd place because it's probably the person without whom Charlie Baker would not even be in politics. Is that not a fair statement?
That is absolutely a fair statement.
Well, thank you very much.
Valerie from Gloucester thinks that Weld could infuriate Trump and keep him busy, and she's hoping a Republican with a brain would challenge Donald Trump.
Well, he only infuriates Trump if the media covers Weld. I mean, you didn't answer my question before. What kind of play is Weld going to get? If I were Donald Trump, I would totally ignore Bill Weld. Don't tweet about him. Don't talk about him. Don't answer questions about him if they're thrown at you. I don't know if he has the self-control to do that. But if Trump ignores him, I'm afraid the media is going to ignore him, too.
Well, Paul says, aside from his base, most Republicans don't like him. They just hate Democrats. They're convinced Democrats want socialism, so Trump is their guy. I think any Republican has a shot at beating Trump in
the
primaries.
What is he talking about? It's not just his base. Every poll shows 85 to 90% of Republicans, not just Trump's base, supports Donald Trump and his policies.
Well, his argument is they don't like Democrats, so maybe they would like a different Republican.
I think it's belied by the polls, but who knows? Rick in New Hampshire, another New Hampshire voter. You're next on Boston Public Radio. Thanks for calling in. Hi.
Well, good morning.
Hi, and to you.
I'm a left-leaning independent, and I was the one who called during the primary last time and said I was going to register as a Republican for the primary so I could vote against Donald Trump.
And did you?
And I did, and I'll do it again.
Yeah, he won last time, didn't he?
Well, you know, it didn't help much. I know other people who are left-leaning independents, and I try to get them to do the same, but I haven't convinced one. In fact, my brother, who's my neighbor, is a Donald Trump supporter.
By the way, putting aside your brother, well, you don't have to put aside your brother for a second. I haven't seen the polling in New Hampshire. Well, actually, I have, but I can't remember it. Trump's numbers in New Hampshire amongst Republicans are just as strong as they are nationally. Is that not right? He's very popular up there, yes?
It's awful, isn't it?
I don't know if it's awful or not. That's for you to say and just not your brother-in-law. Hey, Rick, let us know how the strategy works this time.
What do they like about him? I get what people liked about him the first time around. What is your brother-in-law like about him now?
He's a disruptor.
It's not
isn't
my brother-in-law.
It?
It's my brother.
Oh,
well,
that's
brother,
even worse. I'm sorry. What's your brother like about him now?
He says that all politicians lie and that Trump just does it in your face, which makes him better.
Oh, my God. Okay. Can you get your brother to call the show?
He wouldn't even. I think he's on the road, and I believe he listens to Rush and other right ones.
Okay, fine. Yeah. Maybe he shouldn't call.
Just like Trump, facts don't matter to him.
Rick, thank you. It sounds like you're getting along really well with your sibling. Wish you a lot of luck.
Yeah, this is why
in
people can't have Thanksgiving dinners anymore, right?
Isn't that unbelievable? But we know a lot. I mean, we talk to people almost every single day.
Yeah.
Who says they have a surprise? I mean, either a Trump person who is not crazy because they have a Hillary or a Bernie or whatever supporter, or vice versa. There's still those divides. I still think about that woman. I know I've mentioned her a million times. One of the most powerful and horrible phone calls we've gotten in the last year was the woman who used to call all the time and mention her fiance. And when she didn't, we asked her about her fiance when she called about a year ago. What'd she say? They broke up because she no longer has a fiance because he supported Trump. And
yeah.
She
well,
did not.
I blame Fox News. Fox News has seduced an awful lot of people. Now they got Fox Nation, which makes it even worse. Gene,
by the way, before you take Gene, just one second, Gene. One of our coworkers was kind enough to find out the answer to the question about how Weld feels about the Trump tax cut. There are a couple of things. He said this in Rolling Stone's interview. I think have been good. I favor the tax cut. I never met a tax cut I didn't like. And I think both Supreme Court nominees are highly intelligent. I applauded both of them. Other than that, I think the priorities are just all wrong in Washington. So it's interesting. You've called him a social liberal about 12 times.
Yeah.
He thinks Kavanaugh is a great choice for the Supreme Court. Most people who are social liberals are not
he's a big pro-choice guy, so I'm surprised to hear him say
That's a very good point.
Kavanaugh. Yeah. Gene from Hingham, what do you think, Gene?
Hi, Gene.
Hi. I'm of the opinion that Trump has never participated in a debate.
What does that mean?
He's been there physically. He has never participated. He has never responded to a question. He has never offered an idea. And what he has done was invaded other people's spaces by walking back and forth. What he has done is name-calling, backyard bullying. When are the people who will moderate these debates going to grow up and put an end to this childish behavior?
Well, Gene, can I tell you something? I think the moderators at most of the debates, both Republican primaries and the final, were really good. I would blame his opponents for not being able to have the bell tolled for Donald Trump. I think his performance in the debates is one of the reasons he was elected president. I think people really liked that kind of slash and burn kind of thing. So, again, I don't think the problem of the moderators. Let's see if he has a challenger in a primary or in a final, if the Democrat can take him down. Gene, thank you for the call. Did you not think the moderators were? I mean, wasn't the first question from Megyn Kelly, the now disgraced or disappeared Megyn Kelly, about how he treated women? And his answer was rather horrible. And he got wild applause in the audience. I remember like it was yesterday. Do you remember?
Yes, I do remember it. Did Chris Wallace do one of the debates, too?
I can't
remember. He's usually really, really good. He's one of the guys on Fox News that does a great job. I can't believe he's still there.
He's really good. No, I think it's good he's there, actually.
Okay, we are moving on because we're going to talk with Trenny Kuznarek up next about a lot of sports stories, including, of course, the Boston Marathon recap and my favorite story of the week, Tiger Woods' comeback. You're listening to 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio, live from our studio at the Boston Public Library.
We'll be right back. Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Ginn live from our GBH studio at the Boston Public Library. Yesterday's marathon was supposed to be a dark, wet day. It turned out to be a pretty bright one. Remarkable wins on both sides, women's and men's races. Joining us to recap an amazing race, talk about a standing O that Robert Kraft got at a Celtics game, and, of course, to discuss Marjorie's obsession, Tiger Woods, is Treni Kuznarek. Treni is a sports reporter and anchor at NBC Sports Boston, and she just reminded us totally impolitely that every year we ask her, why are those people standing in line across the street? And she said to us, you ask me that every year, and I tell you every year.
You guys really are
What
old.
Are they doing again?
Like
they
you
are.
Lose what your mind
is
as
we
you
have.
Old.
What is it again?
They get their names and their times engraved, and it's
sure,
free today.
That. Okay, fine.
So that's why.
Okay,
people will stand in line for free anything, guys.
Yeah, there's a lot of people online.
Tell me about it. Nice to see you,
Treni. Jackets. So what are your big moments from the – what are your highlights from yesterday's race?
Highlights from yesterday's race. I mean, the men's finish has to take the cake.
It's great.
Right? Every race I've ever covered, there's been a fairly substantial margin between you know, who wins and who comes in second, but for it to be a sprint to the finish,
it's great.
I can't even begin to imagine. It's hard to sprint to the finish after you've run a 5K, let alone after you've run 26 point, you know, 185 miles. And it was the difference between the winner and the second place gentleman was just 2 seconds. It was the closest race since 1988. There was a 2 second difference in 88. There was a 2 second difference in 1978. Only one race was closer in Boston Marathon history. So it was really exciting to watch those guys break the tape and to see that Lawrence Chirono, who ended up winning the Boston Marathon, he was actually behind Lalisa Decia for most of that stretch down Boylston, and he just made that final push afterwards and took the tape. It was really incredible.
Did anybody interview the number two guy? I saw Chirono interviewed a number of times. Anybody interview the number two guy and how he felt?
I did not. I actually attempted to interview Chirono afterwards. East Africans are, many of them do speak English. They are the softest, and I mean volume-wise, some of the softest spoken people I've ever talked with in my entire career. I literally was trying not to invade his personal space, but like my huge blonde American head was like right up next to his face, and I still could not make out what I feel terrible. We actually did not do a report on him. Like, usually I would ask him some questions either with him or through an interpreter. He didn't want to use an interpreter, and I wanted to respect that. I couldn't, I mean, and you know, this poor guy's exhausted. So I have no idea what I've only been able to pull what they said in the press conference in which they had.
And he pulled some sort of muscle. We had Mayor Walsh with us after we saw Walsh on television putting the wreath from Marathon on his head. And Chirono had to be helped. Was it a hamstring?
I think it was a hamstring. Yeah. And actually, we were going to talk to Werknesh Degafa, who won the women's
side. Well, that was
unbelievable. I mean, she pulled away. You know, the paper today said at the 5 mile mark, but she really pulled away, according to the BAA, at mile 4, mile 5 was her fastest, a 5:12 pace. I believe she ended up averaging a 5:25 pace. The men, for comparison, averaged a 4:53 per mile minute. In their race, but she pulled away about mile 4 and never look back. Every once in a while, you see her looking over her shoulder, but you know, at one point, she had more than a 3-minute lead. And we talked to Des Linden and Jordan Hasse afterwards, who came in third. And
yeah, Jordan Hasse, good for her.
Yeah,
I mean,
third.
I hate to be such a chauvinist,
Homer,
but yeah, Homer. But she's American, and it's always exciting.
Oh yeah, I mean, last year when Des
well.
Linden won, yep. I mean, even in those terrible conditions, I mean, I'm a reporter, sure, but. You know, obviously running is important to me, and to see an American win for the woman for the first time in 33 years, I mean, I was, you know, in tears. It was a thrill.
Absolutely.
But both did very respectable, and I actually double-checked the times today. Wanted to see what Des ran last year versus this year. She actually ran nearly 13 minutes faster this year. She ran a 2:27 even. Last year, her winning time was a 2:39:57. So she actually ran considerably faster this year than she did last year, but she came in fifth. But that's a great finish, both by having a top 10 finish in a major marathon. Both Jordan and Des have now qualified for the Olympic trials for Tokyo 2020. And Des actually said to me in her interview yesterday that at one point she thought during the race, and she sort of hinted at this in our pre-race interview, that she has been contemplating retirement. She is 35. This is a lot. It's a lot on your body. And I asked her, she sort of hinted at it again yesterday. She actually used the R word. She used the word retirement in our post-race interview. She said, you know, about halfway through, about maybe mile 18, I started thinking, man, this is hard. I might retire. She goes, then I crossed the finish line, and everyone's cheering for me. And Boston carried me. She said, I think I've got a couple more of these left.
Did you see the last couple hundred yards?
Oh,
she was waving wildly and throwing
kisses. Oh, it was
kisses.
So great.
It was great.
You guys, she is such a cool person. You know, she obviously we interview all these athletes before on the Friday prior to Marathon Monday, and she was, and they all stay and talk with us afterwards, but she sits and she's talking to us about whiskey and how she, you know, loves to go on whiskey tastings, how she makes her own coffee. You know, we ask her, do you have a beer? Do you abstain from that leading up? She goes, no, I had a beer the other night. You know, and she, of course, we said, what kind of beer? She goes, well, obviously a Sam Adams 26.2. I mean, she's just, she's got this really great, you know, sort of personality that I think sometimes in public doesn't always come through because she's, I think, a little shy being in the spotlight. But also, I mean, Jordan yesterday, all smiles afterwards, just so pleased to come back after a really rough 18 months. She had two stress fractures in her foot. She had to pull out of Boston the night before last year. She had to pull out of Chicago. She wanted to race Chicago. So this is the first time she's been able to race and to come back at 27 years old. I know the globe had her as 21, but she's actually 27. At 27 years old, you know, Des said it yesterday, she's the next big thing in, you know, American distance running. And she certainly has time. Both Des Linden and Shalane Flanagan won marathons in their mid-30s. So Jordan's really just now entering her peak.
And the previous one, the woman that came in second yesterday, she was much older. She's won the Boston Marathon before. I forget her name.
Yes.
Edna Kenyan woman.
Edna Kiplagat.
Yeah,
Kiplagat,
is she 40?
You know what? I need to double check that.
I looked at her age and I was really surprised see that she, I think she was much older than the other runners, which is pretty impressive.
I mean, remember, Meb Keflezighi won Boston in 2014 in very good conditions, very fast conditions that year. You know, just a couple weeks shy, he turned 39 on May 8th.
She's 39 too. I just checked
it out. Yeah, she's 39, so almost 40.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, well, I mean,
almost 40. Yeah. That is true.
Again, I think distance running is a little different because it's very tactical. You know, you can go out for a 5K or a 10K, leave it all out there. You can push it. And if you're exhausted after 3 miles, I mean, no offense to anyone who runs who runs 5Ks, but it's much easier to push it really hard in a 5K than it is to go, you know, to the wall in 26.2 miles. Much of it is drafting. When do you surge? You know, what is the topography like? Do you hold back in the beginning? Do you surge? That's why what DeGaffa did yesterday was so amazing.
Yeah.
And most of the runners, I think, thought she'd fall apart in the Newton Hills. She had never run the course before. She was unfamiliar with it. But she's also just so naturally gifted.
Oh, yeah. The kick on these women, it was almost up to their butt. It was unbelievable.
It's they did something. I saw like a sports science thing the other day that the average elite distance runner, their foot touches the ground for like a half a second or something, where as normal humans, it's like a quarter of a second, which is a huge difference, right? The amount of time it takes some weight off of obviously your bones. And I mean, they just run faster than I can even begin to wrap my head around.
So, Trini, I don't think I've asked you this question. What are those people standing in line for across the street? Do you have any idea?
I don't know, Jim.
Okay,
why don't you go
fine.
Over and ask him an interview?
Now, yesterday, if you had listened to our show instead of doing these interviews, you would have known that Marjorie didn't care at all about the marathon until the finish. All she cared about was Tiger Woods. So, and she did not watch it live. She recorded it and watched
it
at night. So what was your reaction to Woods' historic victory?
I felt so dirty, but I was rooting for him. It's just, you know... Tiger, and I saw somebody tweet this, someone that's like in my age group, and said, like, Gen X, like, we, you know, we're essentially the same age as Tiger, and Tiger changed the sport of golf for a lot of us. I never really watched golf, but to this day, I can remember watching him years and years and years. I mean, the first year he won the Masters with my dad, my grandmother still lived in her house at this point, like the house that she hasn't lived in now. She's lived in a retirement community for years. And I remember it was a warm Easter Sunday, and the windows were open, and we watched Tiger win his first Masters, and I was like, wow, golf is kind of cool. Like, this guy is different. You know, here's someone who does not look like a golfer should look like. He's African American, you know, biracial, mixed race.
Plus,
he's got
he
a little bit
out.
Of an attitude. He worked
none
out.
None of those golfers, champions, when he was 21 and won the Masters, none of them had bodies like Tiger Woods.
I mean, I've seen him in
totally
person.
Totally change everything.
You know, you see him on the course or at the driving range. And not so much now. I actually looked at him on Sunday and thought, oh, oh, he's got a little dad pouch on him. All right, okay, that's all right. That happens. But you know, back in the day, I mean, he was cut like a swimmer almost, very broad-shouldered, really muscular. And listen, I understand that he made some very questionable life choices.
He did.
However, I said this to someone else the other day. He didn't do anything illegal. I mean, I guess unless you consider drugs illegal, but he got addicted to prescription painkillers. Was he a bad husband? He was a terrible husband, what he did to his wife. But if I can be completely frank, many professional athletes are terrible husbands.
Yeah.
It is just, I remember when I first started covering baseball in 2002 and traveling with a team, I was pulled aside on the first road trip and said and told, what you see on the road, you never speak of again. You're going to meet guys' girlfriends. You're going to meet their wives. You're going to meet their third girlfriend. You say nothing about it ever because you're on this team and you're quiet about it. Because I was a team reporter. So I learned very early on, we cannot judge these guys. Again, he did not physically abuse his wife. He's never gotten in trouble for
harassment
no. or murder or assault on someone, which I guess is like a pretty low bar like that we're setting for our athletes. But these guys are human.
But you
and
know,
he's a redemption story. And
it is. And it's been a long time,
yes.
too. It's not like, you know, Charlie Rose decides like 6 months later
right.
he wants to come back after he's been shown to be a terrible harasser.
Or,
yeah, exactly. And what people have said about him that didn't like him much because they thought he was a little punky when he was a kid, kind of nasty and, you know, yelling at everybody.
And I think, to be honest, from what I've heard, he was still a little punky a few years ago. It's really only over the last few years that he has sort of had an evolution as a person and started to look at how he treats others. Because
I've
heard
stories. What's that about?
Somebody I heard this morning, I think, I don't know if I was watching CNN or something, I think it was CNN, and they talked about how, you know, he started to look at what kind of example he was setting for
his children. Oh, okay.
You know, how am I treating others? How am I showing my kids what's the right way to treat others? Because, I mean, I've heard stories just a few years ago when he was on the comeback trail of asking his caddy to fly from New Zealand, meet him at a golf tournament. This is actually, I think, in Armin Katayan's book. Meet him at a golf tournament, and then he arrives there. He rushes. He leaves his whole family. He flies across the world to meet Tiger and be there for him. He arrives. Tiger says nothing to him. He just keeps hitting balls. Doesn't say anything. It's like, I'll speak to you when I am ready to speak to you. But from what I understand from people that are around him a little bit more often, that part of him has started to soften a little bit.
Well, at least he didn't ask the person that washes comb after he ate a salad with it.
Yeah.
You know,
you know what? That person should have brought Amy Klobuchar a fork.
That's a great point. You know, by the way, when you mentioned the swimmer thing, I mentioned this to cut like a swimmer. I mentioned the thing to Marjorie yesterday. One of the moments I loved in this thing, I think it was on the 16th tee, is the announcer, whoever it was, Jim Nance or somebody, made the point, standing right behind Tiger as he's teeing off, the greatest golfer of all time is the greatest swimmer of all time, Michael Phelps, just as a fan, standing in the front of
great.
The crowd. That was really a great thing.
I mean, he really does transcend the sport.
Well, he just, even now, he looks different, and not because he's a black guy or biracial, because he walks differently. He's got that certain way certain athletes walk that is just distinctive. He's intimidating. And
he obviously intimidated the other golfers, almost
all of
whom fell apart in the final.
This great New York Times piece, it was the day after the Masters, that said Tiger Woods showed he was back not with a shot but with a stare, that he got back his mojo, that he had that steely resolve that they saw that he kind of lost in these previous endeavors. And, you know, the whole, when you saw him walking with a look of total concentration on his face as people were going wild on the 15th and 16th hole, you know, he didn't really acknowledge it, but they were like through the roof, you know.
And that's what's made him, I think, one of the, you know, arguably the greatest golfer since Jack Nicklaus, is that this is a guy who, if you're paired with him on a Sunday and he's got that red shirt on and he's within striking distance, he strikes fear in other golfers in a way that a Rory McIlroy, a Jordan Spieth, a Brooks Koepka, other guys who have won major championships and have, you know, some have thought, okay, maybe this is, you know, for a while we thought Jordan Spieth or Rory McIlroy were going to be like the next Tiger, and then they just sort of, you know, peter off
into
the distance.
But you know what's got to be, and it's not an original thought, they were all little boys watching Tiger Woods.
Oh, yeah.
And then 20 years later, they're the stars, and all of a sudden, Woods comes back.
But there was even back, you know, I remember watching, my father was a fanatical golfer and watched golf all the time. I remember watching,
you know. Can you tell the story you told me yesterday, or is that inappropriate for the
era? It is not. But years ago, my father died long ago, but I remember I came down when his brother died. I came down for the funeral, and the brother was only 10 months apart from this. This is his brother. He grew up with his whole life, and I walk in, and I say,
gee, Dad, I'm so sorry about Uncle Bill. And my father says to me, well, that's the way it goes, Margie. Look at Lee Trevino coming up the 18th fairway.
Lee Trevino was a great golfer, you know, 20 years ago, for those who don't know.
But I remember the big complaint about Jack Nicklaus is Jack Nicklaus would take forever to line up his putt. You know, You know, he's standing there forever, taking 19 practice swings. None of them had that mojo of Tiger Woods. Even Arnold Palmer, everybody loved him, Arnie's Army. There's something really different about him, almost in like the Michael Jordan thing in basketball.
So it makes him great.
Yeah, he just is like a super athlete, and that's what I find so thrilling about it. There's not many people like that.
No, and I think it's what makes him great, but it's also what allowed him to be the kind of person that he was, which was not a very great person, right? Because this is someone who, from a very young age, was identified. I mean, listen, some kids, I'm sure there are lots of kids out there who are good at sports, but certain coaches and even sometimes I think, you know, friends, relatives, parents can see that there's a different drive in someone else that's going to make them elite compared to, you know, the kid next to them on the team who's maybe more gifted. And because he was so good and he had that confidence for so long, I think people, entitled him for a long time and enabled him to treat others however he felt like treating him in that moment because he is, you know, athletically more gifted and physically special compared to the rest of us.
Can we move to somebody else who's not an athlete? Who
This really bugs you.
The other night, Bob Kraft, obviously we all know what the background here. We're not going to go through that again. As far as I know, the first public appearance where there were a lot of people, and by the way, he's free to go wherever he wants. He can do whatever. I'm not suggesting he should get a death sentence, no matter what the facts are. He goes to a Celtics game. He's sitting by, I think, Wick Grosbeck, who's the owner of the team. They all of a sudden put a picture of him on the Jumbotron. And then two things happen that I just can't believe. One, the crowd goes berserk cheering for this guy. And again, that's not his fault. He stands up, and rather than, which I think the appropriate thing might have been stay in your seat and just wait till it stops.
Or just give maybe a humble wave.
Stands up. He does this upward thing with his hand, saying, you know, keep it going, raise the volume, and then does a fist pump in the air to these people, which to me is so wildly inappropriate. I both ends of this, the fan reaction and Kraft's reaction, were just surreal.
So I didn't see it live in real time.
Nor did I. We watched it on tape this morning.
Yeah, I watched it. Chelsea sent me the link to it. And it just turns my stomach. And listen, I understand now that they have said that there was no human trafficking.
Right.
Those charges
Correct.
Have been dropped at the specific spa that he visited.
Well, they never, formally, there was never charges. They said
early
on
they were looking into it. And they
right.
have decided that they don't have enough evidence to move forward with those charges. But still, the guy solicited prostitution, and he paid for sex. And yet, for whatever, and there are so many people that make excuses and say, oh, well, he's an old guy, and he did this, and he did that, and that woman chooses to do it. And you know what? Maybe that woman does choose. Maybe that is her choice profession. Maybe there was nothing or opportunities for her. I don't understand enough the psychological dimensions of choosing to be a sex worker.
I don't buy it for a second. I don't think anybody chooses it.
But I have a very hard time believing that, you know, at least initially women choose that lifestyle. Again, I don't know. But this idea that no matter what these guys do,
we
make excuses for them and then we cheer them and then we wonder why they act entitled and why they act as though regular rules don't apply to them. So what lesson does Robert Kraft learn from this other than next time I'm going to be a little bit more careful? Maybe next time when I hire a prostitute, I'll have her come to my house because I know in my house there aren't any, you know, cameras set up. Maybe I will go with an escort instead from a safe, secure. I mean, I don't know how else you would do it, but it's like it's this idea that no matter what you do, no matter how kind of gross and disgusting it is, it's okay. And again, if it was 10 years from now, a la Tiger Woods, maybe I would have a different feeling. Like, hey, guys, what he did happened 10 years ago. Let's let it slide. But this is, it's still ongoing.
Well, remember, it was only a few weeks ago where he released that statement saying, I'm truly sorry. And to equate, I am truly sorry, with
a
guy who
is
standing up and saying,
hold on, can we point out who he didn't apologize to?
To the women.
He apologized to his family, his friends, his fans. He did not apologize to those women. And there may not be sex trafficking charges there, but those women weren't speaking English very well. They clearly were living there. They had
Well, the women, apparently, who were doing him, to use a verb that I guess is as close as I'm going to get, I don't think we're in that boat. But the other women there were that. And but
you're
that's
still,
not
you're still
just
pink,
sit in your
still...
damn seat. And if people are going to applaud, they applaud. But to egg him on in this fist pump thing, it was just
it's
so
gross.
Wildly inappropriate.
And you'd be shocked at how many even like guys that I respect who work in my office were like, well, you know, maybe, I mean, there's a chance, guys, that maybe he just went in and got a happy ending, and then he really did just when he gave her the money. You thought it was just for a massage, and I was like, guys, really, really?
And
you
know,
really,
Jim,
making like.
Do respect. Does it matter if the women, particular women that were doing him, as you put it?
No, maybe you're right.
I mean,
maybe
this is a place where horrible things are going on, where women are doing horrible things all day long, and it's not because they want to.
Right, it's because they're forced to, and yet we're all making excuses for it. I will say this. So the video that you guys looked at and that you posted and sent to me was tweeted out by NBC Sports Boston, and I went through, and a lot of times I won't read comments because they usually turn my stomach, but I will say that I would estimate 98% of the comments were disgust.
Really?
That they couldn't. I was shocked, Jim, that they could not believe that the Garden crowd gave him a rousing, you know, ovation. And that everybody is just looking past this as if it's nothing. There was one guy who stuck out. Of course, he had an anonymous Twitter account, as they all do, who was swearing at people and saying, who cares? And these women are, you know, saying nasty things about these women and that they choose to do it and making excuses. But for the most part, the comments were, wow, way to stay classy, essentially, Celtics
fans. By the way, it's so funny you say that. What did I read before I read the story in the Globe? I read all of the comments on the story. The first three or four pages of comments, every single one was blocked by whoever does the blocking. 100%.
I will say blocked. some of the I block a lot of people on Twitter, and some of the comments that were on our page were like, you know, view this, it's by someone you've already blocked. And I viewed it, and I was actually shocked that most of them were saying, this is gross, what he did is gross. And I was like, oh, maybe I'll have to rethink that.
Trying
block
to atone, exactly.
Trenny,
it's great to see you.
Oh, we had so many more stories we didn't get to.
We got
to
discuss this college scholarship for middle schoolers
next week.
When you're
that's right. I forgot
to
put that on the list.
Yes.
Okay, Trenny Kuznarek joins us every week.
Good
She's
to see
an
ya.
Anchor and reporter for NBC Sports Boston and a Boston Public Radio contributor. Thank you very much, Trenny. Up next, when it comes to rent control in Boston, can tenants keep hope alive? Boston City Council President Andrea Campbell joins us for that. And more next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio, live from our WGBH studio at the Boston Public Library.
Boston Public Radio, live from our GBH studio at the Boston Public Library. The fight to bring rent control back to Boston is pitting the old guard of city councilors against the new. At noon, we'll talk to Boston City Council President Andrea Campbell on whether tenants should keep hope alive or not. Then we open lines and ask you about too young to retire. Last year, a third of MBTA retirees was under age 55. Some will collect pensions for longer than they worked at the T. Is it time to hold our politicians accountable for more meaningful pension reform?
And no matter how you slice it, the cracked pie is not all that it's cracked up to be. Milk Bar has decided to change the name of its famed dessert after a backlash of criticism, saying the cracked pie was making light of an epidemic that largely hurt the African-American community. Then we'll ask food writer Corby Comer about this and more. All that is next on Boston Public Radio, broadcasting live from the Boston Public Library.
From a transmitter atop Great Blue Hill, this is WGBH, live, local talk, Boston Public Radio.
He's Jim Brady. I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. We are broadcasting live, as we do every Tuesday, from the Boston Public Library. And yesterday, of course, was the scene of the marathon finish line.
What do you think of Trenti Kuznarek saying that we ask her the exact same question every year and we never remember the answer?
I remembered it. Don't you remember I said they were getting their medals engraved?
I thought you were just making that up.
No, I thought they were
Knew that?
Well, no, but I thought that was what I remembered, that we're getting their medals engraved. I'm not sure if it's with their name and their time or just their name, but
you know,
anyway.
I'm going to ask her again next year just to make sure that we have it right. So for the city's 2020 budget, Mayor Walsh is putting an emphasis on affordable housing, transportation, and education. He's asking for close to $3.5 billion. Is this a budget that will benefit everybody in the city? That's for the Boston City Council to decide. They'll also decide if rent control might have a second life. Andrea Campbell is president of the Boston City Council. She joins us to talk about this and other city affairs. She represents District 4. President Campbell, it is nice to see you.
Thank you. I always love being back. And I have to give a shout out, since you guys were talking about the marathon, to my younger brother, Xavier, who completed his first marathon yesterday. I don't think he really trained. He said he did, but I don't think so.
It's my kind of guy.
But he finished. I was
good
like, I am
him.
So proud of you. And
what kind of shape is he in today?
I don't know. I left him in bed this morning at mom's house. He was not at his house.
So did you actually see him go by?
I did.
Yeah.
My little guy and I went out there.
Did they have those little trackers now so you knew he was coming?
Yes.
We knew he was coming. It was awesome.
Yeah, that is pretty neat. So you can plan. You could be out at brunch or something, and then you could say, okay, my relative's getting close now.
He slowed down a bit, so we're like, let's go inside. It started raining. Then we came back outside. But he did a great job. And I had another friend, I'll have to add. His name is John Lida. He's from Hoover, Alabama. He's on the council down there, running their council. He came up to run and was remarkable, his first marathon. So it was
Hoover,
a great event.
Hoover, Alabama?
Yes.
Was it like 12 people in Hoover? What is Hoover?
No, there's a lot more than that.
There are?
It's a place, Jim. It's a place.
Yeah, we met through a work exchange program that connects local electeds across the country. And
while
so
you start talking, I'm going to look up Hoover, Alabama and see how many residents there are.
So, Council President Andrea Campbell, there was a piece in the Globe a couple of weeks ago that talked about how you had to be making $78,000 to afford an apartment, one-bedroom apartment in Boston. There was another piece talking about rent control, saying that the median rent for a one-bedroom apartment is about $2,400. This was having to do with reinstating rent control that your colleague Althea Garrison was talking about on the Boston City Council. What do you think of rent control? You think it's a good idea?
So I've been saying this, and this actually came up when she introduced it. You know, we have an affordability problem or crisis from some perspectives in the city of Boston. The question is, if you are a young person, a veteran, a senior, a family of, you know, two or three, and you're working two or three jobs, can you afford to live in the city of Boston? And that's becoming increasingly hard. You know, I was born and raised in this city, and it's harder now than it was 36 years ago. So the question is, are we exploring everything that can alleviate that problem? And I think my colleagues said it best, including Councillor Edwards, who chairs the Committee on Housing and Community Development. Everything should be on the table. We should have a conversation that involves as many stakeholders as possible. And rent control, in that hearing or the council meeting where she introduced it, there were a lot of folks who said it did not work. There are other folks who says maybe, you know, we actually already have it because we have so many deed restrictions in the city of Boston that require units to be affordable, which is a form of rent control. But we need to have a more robust conversation because we don't want to hurt homeowners, owner-occupied homeowners who say rent out a second unit in their home or a second home in the city of Boston where they are truly making it affordable and it wouldn't necessarily allow them to take care of their homes in terms of maintenance and all of that with rent control. So there's varied perspectives.
If I may, my reaction to that argument from at least three of your colleagues is they cannot possibly be that uninformed. Rent control is not something that is delivered. As a former housing tenant lawyer who used to represent people in rent-controlled apartments in New York City, rent control is not written on a tablet and all of a sudden delivered to earth. Rent control is what the city council or the state legislature decides it is. When I read one of your colleagues, which, saying, well, I have a two-family house. So then exempt two-family houses.
They were.
That law was repealed in the 1990s. So the answer is, craft something that protects tenants who can't afford to live city, which I know you care about, and protects small landlords who have legitimate reason to be concerned. So it's fine if one at once says, I'm going to ramble for 30 seconds and I really will shut up and it drives me nuts. If people want to say, I don't like the concept of government limiting rents, I disagree with that, but I'm fine with that position in theory. to argue about the details when there aren't any details, then draft an amendment that protects that which you think deserves protection. But first and foremost, is you and we have got to make this city affordable for people who want to stay here.
Well,
period.
Agreed. Period.
Okay.
And I think I'm looking forward to the hearing where we have the conversation. The challenge is if you introduce something at the council meeting and you don't have an opportunity to weigh in, a lot of folks didn't weigh in on the actual form of it. So that bothered some folks. So it's a conversation we should absolutely have, and we will.
One last thing. We discussed, and I can't remember who the legislator who's behind this, and my apologies to him or her, the common sense bill to me that's pending on Beacon Hill, they'll probably get nowhere, on rent control, basically says if a city or town's governing body, in this case the council and the mayor, decide they want to implement rent control, they don't have to do a home rule petition,
no,
which requires...
NECA.
Who's that?
NECA.
Oh, that is right. That's
our
right.
New
I'm
representative.
Sorry.
That's
that,
right.
That it doesn't require approval by Beacon Hill. I'm so with that. Since it doesn't,
it allows
if you decide
to
you
opt
want
in or out. Exactly.
Rent control. Why is it the business of somebody in Ashland whether Boston has rent control or not, or if Ashland wants it? Why is it the business of a state rep or senator? So I hope that gets serious attention, and I hope you guys give it serious attention too. I'm done, Marjorie. I'm done.
Okay, so the mayor has recommended a new budget, $3.48 billion, up 5% from his previous budget. Before we get to the budget in general, I want to ask you, you talked about the schools in an op-ed you wrote for the Boston Globe saying that money was not necessarily the problem with the schools. You did raise the amount of money in the schools. I think you talked about, well, tell me what you talked about. Yeah. It's how we disperse the money.
So for me, the issues plaguing Boston Public Schools are not resource-based. And what I mean by that is I don't think the solutions to ensuring that there are more quality schools in the city of Boston for our young people to go to, that teachers and staff and principals have the authority they need to be able to execute their policies and plans at the school level. For me, it's not about pouring more money into the problem. So this budget, proposed budget, gives BPS $26 million additional. And I have questions around that. For me, with a system that serves now less than 55,000 students and over $1 billion in that system, the question is, what are we doing with the money we have? So it's looking at efficiencies and also accountability. If we keep giving more and more money, how are we holding the system to account to meet the needs of students and families? And so for me, I think we need to do that tough work first before giving more money to BPS. That being said, I recently had a conversation with some folks from the community. Do we want more money to come into our schools, teachers and school leaders and families to have as many resources as possible? Absolutely. So if the state wants to give us more money, corporations, private philanthropy foundations, I'm not going to say no. But currently, when you look at the BPS budget within the city of Boston's larger budget, I really think we need to have tough conversations around what we're doing with the money we have.
And when you say accountability, what are you talking about?
So where's the money going? If we're spending a large amount on transportation and BPS comes to the council to try to save money and puts forth cost-saving measures and says we're going to save $10 million but only saves $5 million, I have a problem with that when they make that commitment to the council. When it comes to other resources, social-emotional learning supports, family engagement, we pour a lot of resources into these initiatives. Family engagement, this proposed BPS budget is going to pour a lot more money into the central office to do family engagement. And I'm saying, wait a minute, if they don't do it well, why not redirect those dollars to the school level to have a greater impact?
Well, that's one of
accountability.
That's one of the biggest fights, too. All the money going to the central office and not enough money coming actually out to the schools. I've heard that for a long time.
And to decentralize a little bit and to clearly define what is the role of central office, what are the roles of our school leaders and their team members at the school level, how do we differentiate those roles and responsibilities? Because at the end of the day, the schools and the school leaders and the staff and teachers should be accountable to the families and the students. And then central office should be accountable to those school leaders and not the other way around. And it's almost like we have to flip this paradigm upside down to create that accountability. And that's what I want to drive at. And I think if we just keep pouring money into the BPS budget to be able to say this is the largest BPS budget in the history of Boston Public Schools, that's not enough for me.
Did you read the op-ed in the Globe we talked about a week or so ago about comparing the Lawrence Public School funding and performance as compared to
and
the
based on the
higher
report
per capita
that came out
funding?
That's right.
What was your reaction to that?
So I will tell you, Boston Public Schools has a high, you know, per pupil spending amount, not just compared to Lawrence, other places in Massachusetts, across the country. The question is, what are we doing with the resources we have? In Lawrence, if you sort of pull apart what Commissioner Riley did there, they cut central office.
He was the receiver or whatever.
They cut central office, and they took all those additional resources in that power, and they gave it to leaders at the school level. And they said, if you want to get something done in a community at a particular school, you have to go to the school, not go to central office. So they really sort of redefined the role and responsibility. And I think there's something to be learned there. Oftentimes, I think in Boston, we're so proud of ourselves and we pat ourselves on the back. And don't get me wrong, I love the city of Boston. I love the innovation here. But sometimes I think we should be open-minded to look around and say, what is working somewhere else that we can learn from and adopt those best practices? And Lawrence has done quite a bit that we could learn from. And I think people are waiting on us to sort of take these best practices and apply them here.
Yeah, we're talking to Andrea Campbell. She's the president of the Boston City Council. We talked to you last time you came about the valedictorian story, about the kids that had high hopes, smartest kids in the high schools, not the exam schools, but the non-exam schools. Then we learned shortly after that, and I don't know if we had a chance to talk to you about this, from Paul Breville, our education guy, that one of the things they had done in the non-exam schools is basically dumb down the curriculum, that there's a core curriculum that you're supposed to have to go on to college.
We did talk about this.
Yes.
Last time.
Okay.
Yes. You're right.
I found that so upsetting. So it's setting these children up for failure.
You can't meet the standards, lower the standards. I mean,
yeah,
that's
and I thought, how could this have happened for all these years?
I think this is actually indicative of what might be one piece of the problem. It's like, you know, we keep talking about these things. We have a lot of hearings, community meetings. We keep talking about it. Folks in the community, whether it's community organizations, students, families, teachers, people are mobilized and have created that sense of urgency. And the question is, are we in government responding with a sense of urgency in our actions? Are we actually doing what is necessary? And that means challenging the status quo, exercising a little bit of political courage sometimes to think about bold and innovative ideas with respect
are
to
you?
BPS. I am. You know, I'm going to own that a little bit. I am. I mean, it's not easy for me to sort of pat myself on the back, but I care deeply about issues in the education space because I know that my experience going through BPS saved my life and allowed me to go on to a Princeton University, a law school, a successful law school, and have a successful career. And members of my own family did not get that going through the BPS system. So the question is, what do we need to do in the immediate to ensure that every single child has access to a quality school, has the services that they need to be successful, whether they're special ed students, English language learners, poor students, wealthy students? How do we get this system to show up equitably and fairly for everyone? And that's a lot of work.
You know, I'm thinking as you're speaking, Andrea Campbell, one of the debates Marjorie and I have every few months is about elected versus unelected judges, school committee members, et cetera. One of the primary arguments for those like Marjorie who advocates for staying with an appointed school committee as opposed to an elected school committee, it's going to be responsive to all the whims and whatever of politics, is they can be free of politics. Where's the sense of urgency on the school committee's part? I don't live in Boston. I work in Boston. But as an outsider, I don't detect a sense of urgency. Am I missing something with this school committee?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I go around and I talk to a lot of folks on the ground. I spend a lot of time in my schools. And it's not at the top of the list. If anything, it's ensuring that the schools that are currently facing budget cuts get those monies restored, that students have good transportation to get to and from school. One good thing in the budget that I want to applaud the mayor and the superintendent on is ensuring that 7th through 12th graders have access to a Charlie card to get to school. That's a big innovation or investment, I should say, that's in our budget. So the school committee conversation, appointed, elected, or if we should have one at all, is not at the top of the list, but it doesn't mean we shouldn't have a conversation around it.
Andrea Campbell. This idea about this vacant lot, I was really intrigued by this because there are a lot of vacant lots. Tell us what you're doing about, and what is it, more than 100 in your district?
So there are over there are over 1,000 city-owned, not talking about privately owned, city-owned vacant lots in the city of Boston that are inactive, meaning something could happen with them. They could be turned into housing, an urban farming space, a community space, a place for young people, you name it. In my district, largely Dorchester, Mattapan, there are over 100 city-owned that have been sitting there sometimes years or decades where nothing has happened with those parcels.
Yeah.
And we had a hearing. I had a hearing with Council O'Malley. We're continuing those conversations around vacant residential lots and vacant commercial lots. But specifically for those residential lots, and I will tell you, it doesn't get enough coverage because I guess it's not a sexy issue. These are, when you have blighted parcels in your community, especially if it's city-owned, what does that say in terms of how government views your community?
It's insulting.
It's conducive for criminal activity. Yeah. We talk about solving incidents of violence. Well, do something with these lots. Activate them. So we put out a survey through this apparatus or tool called Involved, which was started by an incredible team of folks, or a young guy, actually, out of BU, that literally allowed residents and my constituents and supporters to tell us what they thought these parcels could be used for. People came back with housing, fun space for young people, urban farming or something around urban farming or something involving gardening. And what we did was partner with Wentworth along with the Kingdom of Netherlands. I have a really good friend. I have a really good friend that lives in Amsterdam but went to Wentworth, who went to Amsterdam for architectural school and never came back. He happened to be visiting and said, what can we do together around these lots? So Wentworth in the Kingdom of Netherlands, a.k.a. Amsterdam, funded this weekend activity we called Reclaiming Space. And they took a map of all these, of my district, District 4, all of the vacant parcels, and they created these interactive images, videos. We had design teams that included architectural students and different students from different spaces at Wentworth, along with community residents. And we broke up into teams, and they had to come up with ideas, almost like a mini competition, ideas on how we could activate these spaces. It was a phenomenal weekend. And so now we are sitting with thoughts and ideas on how to activate these spaces. And so the next step is, how do I actually make those ideas, which were informed by community, actually happen? Because the reason we were, or the response we were getting sometimes from the administration, is that we don't have enough resources or community buy-in. And I said, I'm not buying that. When we're in the city of Boston, greater Boston, all the resources pouring into the city of Boston are coming through this city. Chief Dillon, to her credit, I'm going to follow up with her.
Housing is doing
some incredible work. So we're saying, how can we augment or supplement your work to activate these spaces, which are predominantly in Dorchester, Mattapan, in Roxbury,
so
which is very troubling.
To go back to what you said at first, Andrea Campbell, there are 1,000 citywide that are owned by the city. Is that what you said?
That's right.
And 100 in District 4, your district. Is it not as simple on the housing front, forget these other uses, to say to a potential builder or developer, you can have it for nothing? If it turns out, I mean, is that...
That's what I said at a hearing, what I have been saying.
Okay.
But we want to make sure that by pulling in community, some folks do want housing to address our housing crisis. Others are saying, what else is missing in our community? There were a lot of responses related to the need to create really fun spaces for our young people, particularly those who are in the late teenage years. And I'll give you one example. There was one proposal. It was involving e-gaming and taking, this was actually, I think, a privately owned lot, but taking a parcel that's just been vacant in Codman Square, which is in Dorchester, my district, which is near a lot of local schools, and saying, what would it mean to turn this space into a cafe / tutoring program / gaming center for young people, and a space where seniors in the area could volunteer? Apparently, gaming is like a billion-dollar industry, and young people are doing it. What would it mean to be able to do it in a safe space? So activating parcels, not just for housing, and as you said, Jim, but also to meet other needs of our constituents. And so we have some great ideas sitting on the table. Wentworth is continuing to invest in feasibility studies for this. So, I mean, they deserve a lot of credit. And I'm sitting down with Chief Dillon and her team soon to say, how can we work in partnership to do this?
You know, in addition to the kingdom of whatever it is, you should get Hoover, Alabama involved. By the way, I just looked it up. I am so embarrassed. Hoover is a suburb of Birmingham. And it's got 85,000 people, so it's not some little...
And John would appreciate this, because him and his wife, Beth, are now walking around doing the Freedom Trail in the city of Boston.
Well, apologies to him. So, you know, in about 5 minutes, Marjorie's head is going to pop off.
It is?
You should stay to watch this, because we're going to be talking to our listeners...
The MBTA.
...about the story. Did you read the story in the Globe today about the retirees at the T?
I have not.
Can you summarize? Would you mind summarizing it for Andrea Campbell?
That last year, the average retiree in the MBTA was 59 years old. Dozens who retire are still in their 40s. Basically,
a third are under 55.
Basically, until Deval Patrick, and I do take some little credit
for
this.
You do? Because I harassed
him
every month
for this when he used to be the governor. He would come in here once a month. That
I know the governor well. I used to work with him as one
of his lawyers.
Okay. Okay. Yeah, I know. He'd give me that look. He used to piss... Oops. It used to tick him off.
It used to upset you.
I should say. It almost said a bad word.
He admitted on the air, though, that you were part of the motivation.
Yeah, that steely... But after enough haranguing, because it's ridiculous. It used to be you went to work for the T, you could work for the T, 23 and out was the big joke. You'd go there, work at 18, you could retire. Like before you were even, you know, barely 40 years old with free health care. And there's a real problem now because they have more people that are collecting pensions than are working for the T. It's going to break the T. I mean, the T is already broken in some sense. So
is it sustainable?
I don't think it is sustainable.
That's right.
But it's one of the things I think makes it difficult to sometimes get some reasonable reforms in Massachusetts, like when they wanted to pass the gas tax and they wanted to index it and they wanted to have this legislature vote for it again. People read stories like this. You know, they have no pension. They certainly can't retire at 40 and get a $65,000 pension, free health care. So it undermines people's confidence. They think this is a scam, basically.
By the way, this is not a city issue, we should say. This,
it's
obviously,
not.
The city is...
Why are we even asking Andrea Campbell
because
about
she's
this?
A public official and a citizen of the Commonwealth. Okay. She's interested. You're not an elected official.
I will tell you, the city also has to grapple with, you know, the pension responsibilities and liabilities and making sure it's sustainable. And so that's something I applaud the administration, the budget team, and the mayor for tackling head on. But it's a major issue.
I just don't want sure anybody gets to retire in their 40s.
But part of the problem...
I don't know about you. I would love to retire in my 40s and spend more time with my husband and do all the things that are purposeful in my life and with my child.
You haven't been there long enough to get a pension.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, I think it's about... I talk about this all the time, especially if you go to other countries and you look at what we value, right? You know, in this job of being a district counselor... We handle thousands of constituent cases. We're pushing forth policies to activate spaces, make sure we have good schools, good transportation, good budget. You can work, not see your family, not really work on other things that you're passionate about. While I love my job, it's always for me been me serving my purpose and my God-given purpose, and I name that. And I tell folks, go find it. I found it before I was 35. Go find it. This life can't be about work, retire and then die. You know, it really has to, what is your purpose? Why are you here? What do you want to get out of life? So I am for jobs that give a really good living wage, that require an employer to give you something so that when you leave your job that you have some financial stability, not only for yourself, for your family. I mean, these are folks that work really hard, right? We can't discount that. We have unions for a reason. But I think there's a balanced approach to make sure it's sustainable. But at the same time, if someone can retire at 45 and then go off and do some other incredible things with their life, I think that's a good thing.
You do?
I do. And hopefully it's still something that still contributes, of course, to society and the economy.
Yeah, for example, she means playing two rounds of golf a day when you're 45, making $68,000. By the way, I would say I hate when people do what I'm about to do, so my apologies in advance. I was a union president. There's no bigger pro-union person than I. Having said that, I agree with your basic premise. This is an outrage. The notion that we're going to have more, and this is not about you. You have nothing to do
Thank
with this.
You.
The fact that there are going to be more retirees than working people, than people who work at the T, the fact that the average T retiree, at least some of these, not average, I should say, will be a retiree longer than he or she worked for the T, something's broken. And the men and women on Beacon Hill who do have responsibility for this have got a man and woman up and deal with this in a way that's equitable. Because, by the way, these workers, A deal was cut with him during contract negotiations. You can't just abrogate that deal.
That's right.
But there's also got to be a workable, real-world solution.
Well, I think there's a way to do it responsibly, and I think, you know...
So why don't they do it responsibly?
Because
they're scared
of
the union.
No, call the T.
Yes.
That's on the state side. Call the T, the governor in Beacon Hill.
Fine,
I will tell you, folks on the city side who are in unions, who are advocating for them to get a good wage, benefits, to ensure that all the hard work and the dedication to the city of Boston, that we sort of reward that. But the question always is it sustainable? Is it balanced? And you have to be able to have tough conversations around that, not just have the political response. And I agree with you, but that's true for everything, I think, in government. It can't just be with this political lens.
So you feel better now? You calm down a little bit?
No, I'm not calm down.
I didn't think so.
I'm not calm down about this at this at all. I mean,
I am very passionate about people finding their purpose in life and going after that.
Well, I think it's wonderful to find
supported.
Your purpose in life and going after it. But the problem is that most people can't even retire at 65 now. They work until they're 68 and they're 70, and it's difficult to stomach the knowledge that you have state employees, and this is an exception. I mean, other state employees are working until they're 60 and 65.
They are. There's a separate and pension system.
Well, but they work for the Commonwealth of Massachusetts.
Right, and most city employees work for a really long time, decades of service to the city of Boston.
Yeah.
Who've done incredible, incredible work.
And also, I think in other situations, too, that your pension goes up the longer you work, too. These guys are getting pretty hefty pensions in their 40s, which is pretty incredible. But anyway, do we have anything else? Did you want
to talk? No, we don't.
We don't? Okay.
No.
All right, then we're going to move on.
But then, Marjorie, can I say something before we even discuss it? You got to be able to afford the greens fee. And so if it greens fees are expensive... No.
What?
Andre Campbell, it's great to see you. I think we'll let you go if you know
First
what I mean.
First of all, thank you guys for
it's
always having me.
Congratulations to your brother, by the way.
Please I know.
And
will
the
tell
whatever
him that.
Of Hoover, Alabama.
John,
thank you.
Thank you, guys.
And we're not supposed to be sexist, but I really do like your haircut.
Oh, thank you
like
very,
very
much.
So glad you said that because I didn't know if I could.
Yeah, I like it.
She's
with
right.
A little curly Q right
Good
in the
to see
front.
You, Andre Campbell.
Very cute.
Thanks so much.
Andre Campbell joins us every month. She's president of the Boston City Council representing District 4. Thank you very much. Up next, we are opening lines and asking you what Jim just asked about one of my pet peeves, and it's true, it drives me nuts. The MBTA employees retiring in their 40s. I just can't take it. Are they part of the MBTA problem? This is 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. We're live at our GBH studio at the Boston Public Library. And for fans of Marjorie Egan, do not fear. For this segment, we have an EMT on call to make sure that Marjorie gets it through. Matt Stout, right? Wrote a
Matt
great
Stout,
piece.
Formerly
former
the Boston Herald. That's
right. Now it's Globe. Wrote a great piece this morning. Nearly a third of the employees who retired from the MBTA last year were under the age of 55. And according to his reporting, dozens were still in their 40s, and if that's not putting a strain on the pension, how about the fact there are now more retirees living off the pension fund than there are current employees contributing to it at the T, and some people will likely be retired longer than they actually worked at the T. So is it time to put the brakes on this, so to speak? How does that make you feel about fare hikes? 877-301-897. I'm going to repeat my bona fides, if I may, as I just said to Andrea Campbell. I am a big-time pro-union guy. I was president of a union for more than a decade.
Mm-hmm.
There are certain things that are just unworkable, and this is totally unworkable. Years ago, for those who weren't around for Deval Patrick and the legislature did make some reforms, in part urged on, this is not a joke, by Marjorie Egan, haranguing the governor every single month on the same topic, this pension thing. Part of the problem, but it's also, there's an equitable issue. It mostly was reform going forward because there were pre-existing contractual agreements with the employees that were there before the reform that couldn't be abrogated. But when you have a situation, as is reported today, where dozens of people last year retired in their 40s, Steve Crawford, who's a spokesperson for the T Retirement Board, says a couple of them were on disability.
Most
that
of them
is justifiable.
Were not on disability.
Most of them were not. There is a point at which Beacon Hill and, by the way, the Carmen's Union have got to come together and realize this is just not sustainable. I don't mean just sustainable for the taxpayer and the rider. It is not sustainable for the retirement
system. Oh, it's totally
system.
Not.
It's ultimately going to fall apart. Did we not recently have someone on from Frontline who did the story about, were you off that day?
Yes, no, this is happening all over the country.
About public pension systems
yes,
that are
bankrupting the cities and the states where they're from, where
right.
because people are living, and good for, I mean, I hope I do. I mean, people live to their 80s now, and that's a wonderful thing. But the problem is a lot of the life expectancy was a little bit lower then, but I was never quite, no, at least in recent history, in their 40s, but somehow the powerful, it's a wired union. I mean, the MBTA is a very wired union. The Carmen's Union is a very wired union.
Do a good job for
wired
the
union, and yeah, I think the politicians up at Beacon Hill are afraid of them. Baker has been trying to get them into the regular state pension system. That is not working at the moment.
Not yet, no.
And a lot of this information is kept pretty secret. It was hard to get. You know, it was hard to extract all this stuff from the MBTA because I didn't want people to know. And
can I reframe the issue?
What?
Excuse me. I think the question that Marjorie is trying to pose to you, should you be able to work at the T for a couple of decades and then have a pension for a half a century? Is that not essentially
well,
where...
So you work for 23 years,
yeah.
and you get a pension for 40 years.
Roughly...
That's how it works. And these are nice pensions, $60,000, $70,000. I mean, they're pretty good. And it used to be, and I'm not sure if this is still true, because it could have been a change, it used to be free health care. Think about that. Free health care for the rest of your life, not to have to worry about when you get old and retire about Medicare Part B or the donut hole, whatever it is you're supposed to pay extra for when you're retired. I mean, this is it's a great deal, but the problem...
By the way, they get free donuts, too, I should say.
Yeah.
Can
and
I
the
say,
problem is also,
you know,
obviously,
believe?
That we... This is part of the problem why we cannot fix the T, because they're so underwater in their pensions, and... You know, we've taken money out of it for the big dig, et cetera, et cetera,
Why
et cetera.
Why aren't you proposing what you always propose for state cops, that as a one step in the transition to a saner system, even if they're not going to expand the number of years you have to work before you get a pension, that your pension is told. You can retire.
You can retire.
Age,
you don't get your
but
pension.
But you have to wait till you're 65 or 60 or whatever it is.
Yeah.
I mean, that would be an interim first step here.
Yeah. I mean, state police are in great shape. From when I see these state police running around, they're retiring in their 50s. I don't know why they need to retire in their 50s and start getting their pension in their 50s. If they want to retire in their 50s, let them do it and let their pension. The problem is, too, and you don't want everybody to be in the same boat as most private sector people are, because tragically, a lot of people in the private sector can't retire. They're working, you know, as long
Almost
as
nobody
they,
has a defined benefit plan
yeah,
in the private
and,
sector
and
anymore,
so,
at all.
So kudos to the public employees for holding on to these, good pensions. But again, it's difficult when you have people that are retired that can't afford their property taxes, they can't afford anything because they don't have the situation, asked to constantly subsidize these public employee pensions in Massachusetts.
I'm so glad you said what you said, by the way. I mean, you're not arguing, I hope, against a decent benefit for those lucky enough to have one.
No,
you're saying you shouldn't be able to get it at 45 or 52 years old for the next 30
yes.
or 40 years of
I
your
think
life.
You should be, not exactly.
Yeah, okay.
If you want to retire at 40, swell. You know, we always kick around poor Jim Rooney. Jim Rooney's done very well in the state of Massachusetts. He's a nice guy.
By the way, we both like him a lot. He's now head of the Boston
Chamber
of Commerce.
He's a very smart guy. But my former colleague at the Boston Herald, Howie Carr, wrote a piece and saying that Jim Rooney, who worked for the T, and he got out at 41 years old from the T and at a $62,000 a year pension. He's since gone on to work at the Greater Boston Chamber of Commerce. He was head of the Convention Bureau for a while. This piece was written 3 years ago. He's collected $900,000 since he retired from that pension. He's only 57.
What year did he retire?
He's 57 years old.
Yeah. And by the way, if you recall, this is another. Do you remember there was a special deal created for him? Because he retired at 22
Here's
years
what happened. He,
and 4 months of
he
service.
He retired 8 months short of the 23 years that you used to have to work to get your full get your pension from the T and your free health care from the T. And so when he was offered a job by late Mayor Menino, he was 8 months short, and the guy that ran the MBTA retirement fund, John Gallagher, who died this year actually, did a deal for him that was supposed to be for him, and then it turned out that 650 other people took advantage of the same deal.
Only called, of course, taxpayers $2.5 million. 877, not just Rooney's, but all the others. 877-301 80, 9, 70. Does this concern you as much as it concerns
Let me just say one more thing. Part of the reason we're such a mess in the middle class in the United States now is because unions' power has gone down. I mean, I feel
Especially in the private sector.
The Stop and Shop workers are out in the street right now that are, I think, from what I've read, the company's trying to give them the shaft in terms of their pensions and their benefits. I mean, we need more powerful unions. What we don't need is what is basically a ripoff and a scam, and that's what the MBTA has been for many years.
Can I tell you, when you say ripoff and a scam, one last thing I want to say before get to the calls is... While I have a problem with this system as it is too, what I always caution you about when you're trashing the unions for excessive benefits, like in this situation, they didn't unilaterally get these.
No.
The managers agreed to all these things. These were contractually agreed to. They are clearly unaffordable now, and something's got to be done about them. But it was not like the unions stole in the middle of the night and
there
stole these pensions out of some safe.
Wired
it was agreed to.
Unions in
right.
the state of Massachusetts. The MBTA, the state police, I would say in Boston, the police and the firefighters are pretty powerful. And then you have other people, and I always mention them because they are not wired
Social
and they
workers.
Get the shaft, is the men and women who work for the Department of Children and Families who have one of those difficult jobs in the world get paid next to nothing. And I don't understand why, if you can retire after 20 years at the MBTA, then after having to go pick up little babies in the middle of the night from their abusive parents and take them, try to find a foster home when you're driving up and down 93 looking for someone to drop this kid off, your job is every bit as difficult. It isn't about the difficulty of the job in Massachusetts. It's about who's got the ear of Beacon Hill. The T does, the state cops do, the cops and firefighters in Boston have the ear of City Hall, and they get these great deals and other people don't.
Lisa in Boylston, you're first on Boston Public Radio. Thank you very much for calling. Hi.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Sure.
So Jim, you actually just brought up what I've been saying for years, whether it's MBTA, teachers, police, whomever. If you want to retire at 45, that's fine. But if you're just retiring from that job, to get another job, that's not retiring. You know, your pension can sit there, and then when you do retire at 59, 65, 70, then you can access that pension.
Right.
Well, that's Marjorie's idea, not mine. I've stolen it, but I obviously agree with you.
You know, what we used to have going on, Lisa, is you retire from one job in your 40s, start collecting the pension from the MBTA, then you get another state job and you're collecting the pension from the second one. So by the time you get to 65, you got two state pensions going. It's called the famous double dip, Lisa.
Yes, but it shouldn't be allowed.
I don't think it should be.
Marjorie is hoping for a single dip. She will take whatever comes in her direction.
I don't think it should be
Lisa,
allowed.
Thank you.
It shouldn't be allowed either. Steve from Burlington. What do you think, Steve?
Hi, Steve.
Hi, good afternoon. Hey, the problem I have is you guys keep saying all these pensions, they're guaranteed, they work these contracts out, and now we're obligated, you know, you have to honor them. Mm-hmm. I'm in a union. My union is private. Ours isn't guaranteed. My union, they're telling me it's unfunded in the next 15, 20 years, it's going to be out of money. So they're going to have to rechange it. Why can't we restructure theirs? Why are theirs guaranteed and ours aren't?
Well, I promise you, when the governor is here next, we'll ask him that question.
That's a great point. You know, I worked for the Boston Herald for almost 30 years, Steve, and the pension from the Boston Herald is now with the United States government because, like a lot of companies, they lost money, and then the pensioners that expected to get that pension don't have it. I mean, that happens all the time. You remember this terrible story about Polaroid? This is about 10 years ago. But it was
even more.
Was it more than that?
Yeah.
I just remember interviewing those workers, whenever it was, 10 or 15 years ago. They worked for Polaroid their whole lives, and they had these wonderful benefits that went along with it. And they stayed with the company for those benefits. And then Polaroid went under. It went bankrupt. And they lost it all.
Do you remember that was the headline on the front page of the Globe?
They didn't lose it
all.
I forgot
the exact number.
Because this government guarantees, I think, $40,000.
Well, I don't know about that because it was a front page headline. If one of the people back in Brighton can check this out, about how one of the people that sued over that alleged guarantee got a check for something like $9.45. So, you know, you make a good point. I don't know what the law is that governs this. I don't know what abilities people have on Beacon Hill. But it can't be sustained. This is not an anti-MBTA worker kind of thing. It's a pro-sanity kind of thing. and it can't be sustained. Steve, thank you for the call. And by the way, Steve mentions that, you know, the deal is being violated in his own union. One of the grotesque things is what Steve is talking about. When these, I don't know, did he say he was in private, for he was
yes.
a private company? These private companies that basically allow under federal law to decide when they want to. By the way, it may not just because of financial, great financial need. It may be because they want to do well by the shareholders. Oh, you know what it was? I had Ken Feinberg on. Ken Feinberg, who did the One Boston Fund, did the 9/11 Fund, did the fund after a whole variety of tragedies.
Yeah, raised money for the families.
He was responsible for looking into what happened. I think it was the Central States Pension Fund, which was, it was just total greed, screwing people. This, I don't think, is that kind of situation. This really calls for a sane solution and sane compromise between those who run the union, if they want to sustain any pension.
It's also sort of a reassessment because, like I said before, people are healthier now. People live longer lives. So you have to think about how long are you going to have you're going to have a pension for someone. If you retire at 50, you live to your 85. Once again, you've been 35 years a retiree and 30 years a
worker.
Don't
you have relatives who did this, by the way? Now that I think about it, don't you have relatives? You don't? Why are you laughing nervously?
I have some family members that have some good pensions, yeah.
They left early,
I do. I'm jealous. I'm
but
very
they're not,
jealous.
But they were not T employees.
They were not. They were not T employees,
fine.
Yeah. Phil in the car. Hi, Phil.
Hi, Phil.
Hey. You know how I feel about this?
How?
I wish I went to work for the T.
Exactly.
Yes, so do I.
I'd be retired by now.
Yeah.
I'd be playing golf. I'd probably just be coming back from Florida. That's probably what
yeah.
I'd be doing. These guys, they really did something right. What are we doing wrong? That's what I want to know. I went to college. I think I'm a pretty smart person. How come I couldn't figure this out?
Can you answer that question, Marjorie?
Well, that used to be the joke around Boston, right? You get on the T or you get on the Edison.
Edison, as they call it, the Edison.
One. You go work for the Edison.
I love that.
Because they used to have great deals, too. Not anymore, but they did for a while. Phil, thank you for the call.
Thank
I think a lot of people ask themselves that question. You know, when they get to be 50, 55, 60, looking at retirement, they think, oh, my goodness, they should have gone to work for the city or the state. Arthur,
you know, before you go ahead, by the way, one of the things that's interesting in this piece that Matt Stout wrote,
yep.
correct me if I'm wrong, I don't think any state people are quoted in this, are they? Oh, Bill Strauss, actually. Bill Strauss, who I admire, he's the House Chair of the Committee on Transportation, is proposing the legislature create a commission to study the impact of moving future retirees directly into the state pension system, et cetera,
et cetera. Yeah, that's what Baker wants.
Yeah, but future apparently is not enough. And, I, you know, again, I generally, my attitude is if you have a pre-existing deal, you have a pre-existing deal. I just don't understand from having read this article how those who are lucky enough to be retired currently in their 40s and 50s at the T, think the money's going to be there when they're 50 and 60 or 60 and 70, respectively. It just isn't going to work. As you said at the top of this thing, there are more retirees now than there are workers at the T. Obviously, that's not going to work over time.
I would say it's probably not going to work over time. It's not. I mean, that's what the front line do is all these places, public employee pensions where they were going broke. And look at Detroit. I mean, Detroit is really in a mess. All the people there that were looking for the city and that city went bankrupt and they're really struggling. Let's go to Arthur in Norwood. Hi, Arthur.
Hello, Arthur.
Hi. I guess I should be the only person who for the T people getting their pension.
Sure, go ahead.
I think it's an American thing of people always wanting fairness when we clearly know that the world is not fair. Every time Marjorie argues about the unions and now the pensions and the teachers and everything, it's almost like woe is me. But then
that's
you
true.
Guys,
it is woe is me, Arthur. There's no question about it.
But go ahead, keep going, Arthur.
You got me. You got me nailed on that one.
You were stipulating that it's clearly almost always stipulated in the contract that after a specific amount of time they should be able to get their pension.
Yeah, this is
so
not.
I'm okay with the. Sorry?
No, go ahead. You're right. That is contractually mandated. That's how they got this. Go ahead.
Yeah, and if you think about it, really, you're getting $63,000 a year. But does anyone think that you can live on $63,000 a year in Boston after taxes and everything? No.
You don't have to. You can go get another job. Kendra J. Thomas retired at 47 from the T's Wellington garage with $43,406. Kendra can go get another job.
Yeah,
Jean
McEachern, that's what usually happens.
Retired at 48 with $60,353 a year. she can go get another job too.
Like double dipping.
What's that?
I thought Marjorie didn't like the double dipping. You know?
Well, so, I mean, I don't think like you should. You don't have to get a state job, Arthur. I mean, you can. You could get a state job. And I should, to be clear, I'm not sure if you're still allowed to do that. You could get a second pension. I think maybe you can't anymore. But no, you probably get a job in the private sector. So you get out, you get your $50,000 a year pension, then you get another job for $50,000 and you're making $100,000. You can probably squeeze by if you're married. I think you can live in Boston for $150,000, can't you?
Hey, Arthur, thank you for your perspective. We appreciate it. You know what the other problem with this is, which is a bigger problem to me than what your concern is? Mm-hmm. I am actually a believer in the good things that government does. And one of the things that poisons people government is when they read a story about this and they think about the inequity. Someone's riding the T. They know, what was there, a 6% fare increase that the T board, the fiscal control board voted a few weeks ago. If I was one of those people, and I drive almost every single day, but if I was one of those people, I would probably say, well, wait a second. I have to pay a 6% increase when the T is mostly not on time, and there's a Gene McEachern who at age 48 retired with a $60,000 pension. I don't know who Gene McEachern is. I don't mean to pick on her, but there is the disconnect that causes people to say, I can't expect to be treated equitably by my government. I mean, it sends a real
well, it also,
message.
even though the T is state, lots of times overrides fail in Massachusetts mm-hmm. when people are trying to fix the schools.
Prop 2.5
and I think it's because it's hard for people, especially people who don't have pensions and are really struggling in their older years, to raise their own taxes. When they hear about stories like this, when they feel as though other people in town, I mean, Arthur's right. I mean, the life is not fair, but I think when you're asking someone to raise their own taxes and you see stories like this,
it
undermines their ability
to
do that.
We have time for one more.
Ann in Cranston. Hi, Ann.
Hi, how are you today?
Great. Marjorie's not.
Hi,
I'm fine.
Today?
Good.
I'm good. Marjorie's not.
Good.
Go ahead.
Good. I'm from Rhode Island, mm-hmm. and I think that the MBTA should look at what current Governor Gina Raimondo did as general treasurer 5 or 6 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Got rid of COLAs, raised the retirement age, couldn't collect until you met a specific number, which was a combination of your age and your years of service. You know, maybe they shouldn't, if you know, you retire, fine, but you don't get your free medical until you reach that age. There's a lot of things that should be investigated, and I think what Gina did with the state pension plan is a great place for an MBTA to start.
Can I tell you something, Anna? We have talked to your governor a few times about that, and I don't know enough about the merits of it, unlike what you do.
I know she barely
but
hung
Gina
on
Raimondo,
because of it.
Well, not
she
just
took
this
a
time,
huge
her first time,
political hit.
After she was treasurer, mm-hmm. she basically advanced something that was likely to be a career ender. And you would like to think that the people who make decisions on Beacon Hill would be willing to take the same sort of risks to do what they think is the right thing to do. So, Ann, we're glad you brought it up. I think she's going to be with us at the end of May, by the way, Governor Raimondo again, at which time we will probe this a little bit more in light of what happened at the T. In the meantime, good for Matt Stout, former Heraldite at the Boston Globe, for exposing this. And people, what I started to say, and I didn't finish my own sentence, while Bill Strauss, chair of the House Transportation Committee, has a reaction, I hope is a follow-up story tomorrow in the Globe, asking Governor Baker what his reaction is, Senate President Spilka, Speaker DeLeo, what's their reaction to this? Put them on the spot and let them see if they're satisfied with this, if they think there needs to be change.
Yeah, I mean, maybe after enough stories like this or not, they don't have the clout that they used to have. I don't know. But Baker, anyway, is saying they should go into the state pension system.
What hasn't happened, though, has it? So
no,
saying
it has not.
It is not really
it
enough.
Has not,
would you
it
not
has
agree?
Not happened. That is correct.
Okay.
Anyway, up next, Hungry While Black. Why did the college student foraging for food get pinned by the campus cops? And why did he need to find free food in the first place? Food writer Corby Cummer joins us for that and more on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio. He's Jim Browdy.
And she's Marjorie Egan.
And this is 89.7 WGBH, WGBH HD1, Boston.
Online at WGBHnews.org.
Boston's local NPR.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I am Jim Browdy. Marjorie Egan is calming down. We are live from our GBH studio at the Boston Public Library. Is Milk Bar's famous pie all that it's cracked up to be? Not anymore. After getting tons of legitimate criticism for naming its signature bake the crack pie, likening its yum factor to a drug epidemic, they've renamed it the Milk Bar Pie. And while we're talking nomenclature, Twitter's Jack Dorsey calls his extreme diet of fasting biohacking. Nutritionists might call it billionaire baloney. Joining us to talk about these stories and other headlines about food culture and food policy is Corby Kummer. Corby is an award-winning food writer, nominated for James Beard Award, I should say, a senior editor of The Atlantic, and a senior lecturer at the Tufts Friedman School of Nutrition and Policy, and a BPR contributor. Hello, Corby Kummer.
Well, hello there.
And hello to you.
Well, let's start out with the famous crack pie, which I guess Jim Browdy has tried out many times.
Well, I want to be sure, by the way, at Momofuku in D.C., Milk Bar's the dessert part of the deal. Is that, am I right about
that?
Yeah,
they're linked. They're linked businesses.
So fine.
Chang,
so I've had it there.
The original investor with Christina Tozzi. Yep. He still has a big interest in it, but she's been a very successful entrepreneur, made a whole TV identity for herself, and it was her fault that she didn't change the name Crack Pie earlier.
But have you had it, by the way? I have. It's unbelievable.
I have.
And, ooh,
is it fantastic or not fantastic?
No, here's what I think. Everything about their sweets, especially the crack pie, is, which is no longer the crack pie, and the cereal milk is,
oh, the
they're
cereal
really
milk.
Heavy in salt. Oh. And so what you are saying is, I like salted caramel, I like salt with my sweet. So I don't. I don't like salty sweets, so I'm not fond of it. But
ooh, I would love it.
So why did they...
Okay, off you go.
One of the things I don't understand is they succumbed, as they should have, to pressure of late. Why was there not pressure earlier on about this? I'm surprised that this crack pie name lasted as long as it did. What's that about?
We've talked about this once or twice.
We have?
And I, yeah, on this show.
Ooh, was I here for that?
Yeah, you were here for
it. Oh, I wasn't paying attention. That's what it was. I knew that. Now I remember.
This is like my marriage. So it's partly post-Me Too, in which the idea of being very careful about terminology finally started to come in.
Can you hold it 1 second? People back in Brighton...
Yeah, something's wrong with the microphone.
No, but it's not brushing up. Just change the mics. Change the headset.
Yeah.
Margie and I will talk to each other. How are you doing, Margie?
I'm doing very well, Jim. How are you?
Nice to see you.
Did you like the crack pie?
Actually, I liked it, but now that Corby has spoken, and I know we've discussed it many, many times, I don't like it anymore.
Okay,
okay,
then let's
Corby,
move on.
Speak. Let's hear how this is.
So crack
Ooh,
has
yes.
Much better.
Racist overtones. It was a big problem in the African-American community, and the idea of naming something addictive because it's so wonderful. Now the politically correct food writers are saying, I will not use the word addictive. I will not ever use the word crack. It's like crack. It started out as a joke. I don't think it started out as a mean to offend, meaning I can't keep away from it. It's so good. But now that opioid addiction and deaths are one of the most prevalent causes of suicide and deaths in this country, there's nothing funny about it.
Can I ask you one last thing about the local iteration of the Milk Bar? They're in tandem with Pizza And. Are they not in Harvard Square? Is that where that thing is?
They might share a space. I don't think there's a business.
Oh, they're not formally. Because, you know, Pizza And, which I have a real problem with, coming to Harvard Square. Do you know what their history is in New York City?
I don't think
where this cult leader who runs this company urged that employees have the ampersand Pizza And
yes.
tattooed on their body. I found that really, really, really troubling.
You're not making this up.
No, not only when I did a thing on it on Greater Boston. It is. You should check it out, if I may give you a little advice here. I don't know if they're doing it in Boston. I haven't followed that, but I know in New York City.
So I now plan to shame anyone carrying a Pizza And box.
Yeah. Well, can I tell you, the line outside in Harvard Square near where I live is quite intense most days. I am told that the line is less for Pizza and more for Milk Bar. And pizza. I'm sorry. Thank you, Tori, for correcting me. It's and pizza. I got it backwards. But it's the ampersand that was the issue in New York City. So check it out and take it from there.
Okay.
Here's the deal. And pizza. This is a story from, I don't know where it's from, says they offered customers, the customer thing doesn't bother me as much, a year free pizza if they had the ampersand tattooed on them.
But apparently they, as I say, urge, don't mandate, even though I think there's a fine line, that employees in their other locations in D.C., Maryland, Virginia, New York, whatever, do the same sort of thing. So check it out if you would. Ooh, look at the look on your face.
No, I'm thinking Harvard students have to mobilize against this.
Well, actually, some did. That's how I heard about it.
They have to use their social networks. They have to start posting pictures of horrible, disfigured, discolored tattoos of ampersands and start, like, pasting printouts
out the window. Well, you know who else has to rally people? James Beard Award nominees.
That's
for
right.
their writing skills.
James Beard Award nominees.
That's right. We have incalculable
well.
Influence yeah. in this
You're
country.
You're in a very elite Don't club forget. There. I mean, of the really the best of the best. Anyway, let's move on to somebody who's in a little trouble. I guess they're both of them. It's two white restaurateurs that decided they were going to open a Chinese-American restaurant in Manhattan advertised as quote-unquote clean Chinese food. Did not go over well.
So let's think about what the current, I mean, why am I bringing this to meat and artificial cell-cultured meat? Because the cell-cultured meat business is trying to call it clean meat. And the Impossible Burger, all lumped under this idea of clean meat. What do the ranchers, the good ranchers across the land think? Our meat isn't dirty. What are you saying? It's dirty. And so this really tin-eared woman named Ariel Haspel, a Manhattan health coach with a sleek social media presence,
I love that.
The item in the New York Times.
What does that mean, a sleek social media presence? That's what I want to know, Corby. What does that mean to you?
Probably it means she pays a consultant to maintain her Instagram and Twitter accounts.
Maybe
but especially
we should try that.
It's Instagram. That's what it means now. And so she advertised that lo mein wouldn't make people feel bloated and icky. And the food wasn't too oily or salty.
Oh.
And she called it Lucky Lee's. You know, it was as if she were going to then pronounce her name Aurier or Hasper or something. It's the most old-fashioned Charlie Chan parody. And she didn't realize how this could offend Chinese restaurateurs who would say, oh, so everything we serve is dirty and it makes you feel icky the next day. And instead, she was just being virtuous and appealing to her Instagram clientele.
Didn't Andrew Zimmern have a similar problem when he opened whatever
yes.
in Minnesota or wherever he is?
It was the first thought that occurred to both of us. It comes up very late in the Times item.
Oh,
but yes, Andrew Zimmern said a kind of the same thing. But without saying it quite that bluntly, I'm going to make this wonderful, so much lucky cricket, he called it, so much more authentic version of the food that I, as a New York-raised Jew, will make better than anyone from a Chinese heritage. And Ariel Haspel is saying, but you know, it's a very authentic restaurant. The textiles are just what my 1930s rag trade grandmother, Jewish grandmother, would recognize. You know, nothing goes together in this picture with any kind of cultural sensitivity. It's just astonishingly
so dumb. How do people like this come out of this? Because in some ways, I say, well, the woman is experiencing a lot of pain. And by the way, on day one, she apologized. I have no idea if it's sincere or not. I'm reading it, not hearing it.
Doesn't
but I would
sincere.
Bet her profile is 1,000 times higher than it was just based on her Instagram output. And do we have any idea how restaurants that do this kind of thing, how they fare in the long term?
I know. I really have a feeling that all the women are going to take their Lululemon yoga mats straight to her restaurant.
Okay.
I don't think it's going to harm her.
Okay. So tell us about Oprah and her avocado orchard. Apparently she bought an entire one because she didn't want to pay for avocados at the store.
So before you do this, can we play the sound? We actually have the sound from this.
Oh,
this,
good.
This discussion that Oprah had was with Trevor Noah. And he asked her about being wealthy and famous for so long. He asked her a great question. Is there anything she does that is normal in her life? And here is the Oprah Trevor Noah back and forth on that very subject.
Now, I will tell you, though, something's very normal that
yes.
you wouldn't think.
Okay, let's go.
I travel with my own bread, and I bring my own avocados.
Are you serious?
Yes, I do. So I have an avocado orchard, so I think
it's... Oh, the story got not normal, Oprah!
Yeah, no!
You just said I'm going to tell you something
no,
normal, then
no,
you said I have my own avocado orchard.
Okay. But, so I think it's ridiculous to pay for avocados.
Which is why you bought your own orchard? Are you kidding me? That is not a normal story.
Okay, all right.
I made my own avocados because they're too expensive.
That was a great exchange, I should say. Why are you frowning?
No, I'm thinking good for Trevor Noah, getting it right away. Right on it.
By the way, his book, his autobiography, is fantastic.
Born a Crime.
Born a Crime. It's amazing the childhood he went through and what he became. Anyway, as quick as
so, what this is like is Howard Schultz, when asked about the price of a box of cereal, and he was told it was like $5. He paused in awe and said, "Gee, that's really expensive." And nobody said, "What's the price of a Frappuccino or the calorie count?" It's like, you know, think a minute before you talk about your care for the working person.
Yeah.
Well, I would say, though, in fairness, the high watermark for that campaign,
as is often said,
was pretty much the day that he announced.
Corby said he just investigated what happened to Howard Schultz.
Where is the Howard Schultz candidacy?
Yeah.
And I got something from last week saying in 3 days he might announce. He's getting closer to announcing.
You're kidding.
Oh, he hasn't formally? He's just doing one of those exploratory kind of things?
Oh, no, he has not announced. No.
Who was the person who did the incredibly sycophantic? Was it on 60 Minutes? Was the initial interview with him on 60 Minutes?
Or CNN.
Someone tell me back in Brighton, who was the guy who was in love, who did that first interview where we first saw Howard Schultz as a potential candidate? We're talking to Corby Kummer, our food guy.
Okay. Tell us about the guy that founded Twitter, this Jack Dorsey, and his weird diet.
So Jack Dorsey is weird in every way. He's really good looking, so he's on many, many magazine covers and our very own MIT Technology Review, Wired, New York Magazine. He's been on every cover. He looks like a model. And then he went away from Twitter for a while, and he came back and he grew this endless, scary mountain man beard. And he would go to stockholder meetings sporting this beard with no explanation at all, like, "I've just been communing with nature and the Unabomber for a year and a half in Montana." You know, this was never explained. So now he is saying that he goes without, he has a 5-2 diet. So he eats 5 days a week. But what does he eat? Maybe some asparagus and fish. Maybe. And then on the weekends, he eats nothing. And why is that? Because he wants a very long life and because he feels ecstasy and odd concentration at the end of the 2 days. And this is spreading like wildfire across the Silicon Valley. It's called intermittent fasting or intermittent eating.
Amongst the big boys or amongst everybody?
No, everybody. Really? And especially executives, because the idea is, you know, Silicon Valley thinks it can cure everything, mm-hmm. including death. And so this is a way of living longer, and they call it biohacking. And this very thoughtful, provoking piece in the Washington Post by Monica Hess, who writes about gender
really
issues.
Really good.
So good. Saying when women do it, it's hysteria, it's anorexia, it's an eating disorder. They're much too unhealthily obsessed with calories. They should just get real and stop being so afraid of food. When men in Silicon Valley do it, it's biohacking. And they're bros. But what she leaves out, it happens to be that I've seen a lot of women, there aren't a lot, but women tech execs in Silicon Valley say the same thing. This is the future. This is how we control our own bodies, our own disease, our own destiny. And there's nothing healthy about that much fasting that often. It's very frequent now.
Why are you making a face, Marjorie?
Because I always go back to the maiden aunts that lived like 96 and 97, and their whole refrigerator was full of Pepperidge Farm
but
cream cakes.
Are you about to get out the cigarettes plus the Winstons?
What's the moral of that story?
Well, the moral of the story is I think
Pepperidge
that people.
Farm?
No, I think the moral of the story is people that think they control their own bodies are delusional. I mean, no matter what you do.
Silicon Valley thinks it can cheat death.
Yeah.
They found their way out of every other problem, including disease and death.
Yeah. I control your weight, I suppose, but you certainly can't control diseases. Before
we switch gears to the next sad topic at Columbia University, in your honor, which is the phony burger that they sell at Whole Foods? Is it Impossible
it's
or Beyond
Meat? It's
the
better one. It's Beyond. Meat.
Because of you, Corby, I ate one this weekend.
Oh, you did?
And you know what I did? I meant to tell you this. And I did all the things you should do to disguise it. I put tomato, lettuce on it. I put pickles, which I rarely do on a cheeseburger, but decided I would do it only to sort of hype
disguise.
The effect. It really doesn't. I'm not with Marjorie. I wouldn't spit it out like Marjorie did, really disrespectfully on the air that day. It was disgusting.
But you remember that? It was really
disgusting. I do. It was awful.
You know what it's like? It's like soda, and I don't like soda or diet soda, but when I used to be a kid and used to like take Pepsi practically intravenously, and then what was introduced? Was Tab the first diet
Tab.
Drink?
Whatever Tab.
The first,
yeah.
And the taste was so different and horrible. That's how I feel about this. So is this one of these things where sort of like a school lunch where if you eat it, what is it, 7 times and it's healthy, you finally are okay with it? If I do the burger 7 times, am I going to feel better? I'm willing to try. Am I going to do better or is it hopeless?
No, they have to improve the flavor. I think they've improved
enormously.
But I think if you are really used to ground meat, you are not going to be satisfied. Therefore, it is incumbent upon us, Jim, to go when Burger King offers its Impossible Whopper.
Is it here yet or not?
I don't know if it's here. It's coming soon, and therefore the dreaded day of the taste-off, someone is going to give us bites of both the Whopper and the Impossible Whopper, and we will blind. So we have to decide which is
which. Oh, I'd love we'll do that on the air. That's
we have to do that.
What was that thing we did on the air? Was that like the lobster from McDonald's? What was that horrible thing?
Oh, the lobster from McDonald's.
It was like eating mush. Jeez. Remember that? It was horrible.
No, I didn't try
that either. Salted
Yeah.
Okay, can you tell the horrible story of Alexander McNabb, a Columbia University student who was nothing more than hungry and preparing for an exam, and what befell him
so
when he tried to
what
get
is
free
more,
food?
Well, what is the most important thing on campuses, as we could argue for many large offices, free food. Mm-hmm. So there's an actual website at Columbia and Barnard, the affiliated schools in New York City, that says, okay, here's where there are leftovers, here's where there's free food. It was the end of a night. He'd been to a dance class. He takes dance. It was on the Barnard campus near the library. It was party leftovers. And he went without his ID, which was against rules. But as he was going, two policemen said, excuse me, and they stopped him. He didn't have his ID. He was kind of booked, and a woman, white woman, Columbia Barnard student, filmed the whole thing, and I watched the video. Did you?
You did? No, I have not.
It is so disturbing because it's this guy who looks like any other student. He's wearing an odd kind of frock coat, but he was completely profiled. Completely typed, and no matter what he said and no matter what the other students said, they wouldn't let him out. And this was not the first time it had happened to him.
Third time, actually, I believe it was.
It was the third time, and it's the same kid, and he was trying to prepare his thesis, and he had to eat for fuel to get through his the home stretch of his thesis. It's just a horrible story.
Well, you know what was almost as disturbing to me as how this young man was treated originally was how unwilling the school was to do a full-throated apology here. He did a wonderful thing. When he testified at some hearing, he referred to himself in the same way that the university referred to him as the student. They couldn't even say Alexander McNabb's name. You know, it's one of these things. We discuss the art of the apology a lot on this television, this radio show, Marjorie and I do. And it seems to me if Columbia had owned this and Barnard had owned this in a serious way, it doesn't undo the damage that was done to this young man in that campus, but it shows at least in some way that you get it and care about it. And in my estimation, they just compounded the misbehavior by their unwillingness to own up.
They were the opposite of Howard Schultz. Even if he's shocked at the price of a box of cereal, when a Philadelphia Starbucks did a similar thing, black customer use the bathroom, and it was videoed by an onlooker, and that video went viral, and it was bad and embarrassing, Howard Schultz closed the stores for an afternoon and did racial sensitivity training. So that was owning it in a big way.
I agree. By the way, Scott Pelley was the guy who did that sycophantic 60 Minutes interview. Thanks
probably
to the
all focused on his apology.
Maybe
so,
it was.
So, Corby Kummer, you James Beard finalist, you. I love this next story about the guy that's become a certified snail farmer, and he's growing the snails inside. I mean, this is pretty cool.
No,
I didn't
you
know
are so unlikely as a lover of a story about a snail farmer. What is this you like about
this
story?
Well, I just thought I didn't know anything about these snails, that the snails deposit eggs out of the hole in the back of their neck, and they have 50 to 100 eggs there, and they're kind of, I think that they're hermaphrodites, which is also interesting. And then the little eggs go down there, then the snails just crawl up out of the soil. He talks about what he feeds them, dandelions and clover and wild greens. I just thought it was a fascinating
little
story.
So I have a future for you. Collaborate with your daughter on a children's book. Every mother-daughter team writes a children's book. You have it right
now. The snail book?
The snail garden in the backyard. Well, yes, it's absolutely charming. Anyone who comes to know snails loves them.
Not her.
Slow food movement. The whole symbol is the snail. But are you going to go out and keep him alive by buying his snails?
Wait a
and
second. Marjorie, has a snail ever crossed your lips? Not a chance
escargot.
In the world. You've had escargot?
I absolutely have.
Look at me when you
they're
say
wonderful.
That. I don't believe that.
No, they're full
no
of
way.
It's full of garlic and oil, right?
It's garlic
well,
and
butter. Can be. Depends
butter,
on
how
you
butter, even
that's,
better.
That'll
even
get
better.
You, Marjorie.
Exactly.
Okay, so
all
you're in it for
salt,
the butter.
And I'd be perfect.
So and a what little is the, parsley.
Is the point of the story that there are not a lot of snail farmers in the United States, or the fact that this chef decided to stop cooking? And the verb they use is wrangle. I don't know if that's jargon or not, but it's not farming, it's wrangling. Whatever the hell it is that he's doing. Is that why this is newsworthy? Because he's an outlier?
It is not newsworthy.
Oh, it's not
and
newsworthy.
I don't understand why they do this story. So I think that the writer is the Scott Pelley of the Times Q&A. Because I kept reading this and thinking, I've read about snail farms in the U.S.
You
yes,
have?
They are.
Well, I never have.
They are much better because right now all the snails we get are imported. Generally, they've been shipped a long time. They've been preserved. They're just not nearly as good, although frozen they can be better.
But do Americans even eat snails?
I would assume. Not much.
Not much.
No. So, I mean, what's charming is this guy's photogenic. He has this cute farm that has completely captivated Marjorie, and she's going to start one in her backyard. And, yes, snails are charming, and, you know, it's going to make a delightful show and tell when you have visitors.
Okay. So you were totally unimpressed by my snail farm story.
Do you know this guy or do you not?
No.
Taylor, what's his
all.
Name, Knapp? Is that what
Taylor
the guy's
Knapp.
Name? Taylor
yeah.
Knapp, yeah.
So tell us what happens with the James Beard Awards. Now, you are in the finalist section at the moment for the piece that you wrote about the presidents of winery.
Wine. Yeah.
Now, what
he happens?
Happens
to have it with... Oh, no, we're going to get to that next week. We want to talk Trumpian wine for a couple of
yeah,
minutes.
Yeah, but I also want to find out what happens with the awards. Where does it go from here?
Well, you know, it goes to embarrassment, humiliation, and doom. That's where it goes.
You have to, go to,
I mean,
you have to go to an event?
There's a very
like
fancy ceremony in New York City at mm-hmm. the end of the month in which... There's a nice dinner and lots of speeches, and then the tortuous wait, because they break up the categories, and there's a million categories, like a two dozen or a little less than two dozen. That's a lot to get through in an evening. You have no idea what the rationale is, because it's mixed with the books and TV and radio. One day I'm going to get this show nominated.
Oh,
I
good.
Set it on the air, and it's going to happen. Or we're going to try. And then you have no idea what the rationale is because they mix it all up. And they mix it between courses. And they mix it between patter. And so then your moment comes and your name isn't called. You go down to doom. But I have a buddy who is also going spouseless to this. And we've decided we're banding together.
Okay. You have to have a speech ready, right?
It's a rather negative attitude, Corby, I should
no,
say, about
people
the
prospect
you're
winning.
Jew, what do you expect?
I'm a Jew.
Okay.
Nicely put.
Food writer Corby Cummer joins us every week. He's an award-winning food writer, senior editor of The Atlantic, a James Beard finalist, and there's not very many in the entire country, and a senior lecturer at the Tufts Friedman School of Nutrition and Policy, and also, of course, a Boston Public Radio contributor. Corby, thank you very much.
Thank you, Corby.
Coming up,
nice to see you.
CNN's John King is here to go over the latest headlines coming out of D.C. and today coming out of Paris, France. He's next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio, live from the Boston Public Library.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy. She's Marjorie Egan. We're live from our GBH studio at the Boston Public Library. Even though Pete Buttigieg and Bill Weld have officially announced their presidential candidacies this weekend. Believe it or not, there are actually more people running in yesterday's marathon than there are people running for the Democratic and Republican nomination combined, barely. Joining us online to go over the latest political headlines is CNN's chief national correspondent, John King. John is the anchor of Inside Politics, which you can catch weekdays at noon and Sunday mornings at 8. Hello, John King.
Good Tuesday to both of you. That's true this week. Are we sure by next week there won't be more presidential candidates?
That's right. So, John King, I just wanted to start. We've been seeing the pictures running over and over again on your station, CNN, of Notre Dame Cathedral in Paris burning. Now, apparently, it's up to $700 million offered to rebuild it. But I just saw a chyron that said much of the wooden interior of the church is gone.
It's so sad. I mean, my show's about politics, and yet we dedicated about a third of it today to this because it was interesting. It started right at the end of the program yesterday, and we didn't know about it until I got downstairs. And I assume you guys had the same afternoon I did. You're watching the pictures, and you're sort of gripped by it, and you're horrified by it, and you're saddened by it. And it is interesting. Number one, it's a historic global landmark. Yes, it's an important place for Catholics and the Catholic faith, but it goes well beyond that. It's just a historical landmark, and anyone who's ever been to Paris has made a point of going inside or sitting in a cafe across the street and staring at it because it's so beautiful. What's striking to me is that in today's world, most Tuesdays we talk about, you know, the president is breathing fire on this person and that Democrat is breathing fire on that person. There's so much conflict and controversy and separation that look at statements, whether it's the Pope or the president of China and the president of Russia, the president of the United States, normal everyday people standing outside the cathedral or interviewed around the world. It's just one of those things where everybody stops and everybody's on the same page, which is this is horrible and terrible. And let's hope, A, the artifacts can be saved, most if not all. And then, B, get about the rebuilding.
You know, John, I don't want to rain on that international leader parade, but I thought what Donald Trump, he once again decided to get himself right in the middle of this thing and tweets about flying water tankers. And then a French agency deems it appropriate, and I would have done the same thing, to tweet hundreds of firemen of the Paris Fire Brigade are doing everything they can to bring the terrible Notre Dame fire under control. All means are being used except for water bombing aircrafts, which, if used, could lead to collapse of the entire structure of the cathedral. You know, in the middle of this horrible trap, it's sort of like when he said, you know, I told Theresa May what to do, and if she had listened to me, it would have been fine. But, of course, she can do whatever she wants. There is no situation where our president does not feel like he needs to get himself right in the middle and that he knows better than anybody else. And I love the fact that these French leaders or security people decided it was appropriate, even though not to name him, to say, mind your own business. We know what we're doing here. No?
You make a very correct contextual, let's call it an amendment to what I said to start the program. His reflex is if you're stuck on Star Road Drive right now, watch the president's Twitter feed. He'll get you out of traffic somehow because he thinks he alone, as he likes to say, has the answers. He's smarter than the generals. He said it himself. Well, stupid people made all these trade deals. He talked about Boeing rebranding itself the other day because of the 737 MAX issues. You're right. His impulse is that every story has to be about him. Or he has to be a part of every story, even watching the tragic burning of, again, a global architectural and religious landmark. So you're right about that part. He can't help himself, and the firing back. And not only about the structure, but the French also made the point that you just randomly dump water from above. Not only might you collapse the structure, you might also destroy some of those artifacts, which, thank God, most of which so far, we were told, have been taken to safety.
Well, not to mention the fact that it's not any of his business. You know, John, we started today's show by discussing the candidacy that was announced on your station yesterday with your colleague Jake Tapper. Bill Weld, our governor, I think roughly a quarter of a century ago, it ended. The vice presidential candidate on the Libertarian ticket until he sort of endorsed Hillary Clinton, I guess you could say, in the last election cycle. And as he said recently to one of our colleagues, as he wants a debate as one large orange man to another, we discussed it with our listeners at the top of the show at 11, and while there was a lot of anti-Trump animus, Marjorie, is it fair to say there was not a lot of pro-Weldian enthusiasm? Is this a...
Well, I think people thought it was futile.
Right, too. Is this a quixotic effort on the part of our former governor?
If the goal is to beat President Trump in a Republican primary, yes. You know, Bill Weld is hoping to be the guy on the ballot when something finally happens. You know, if it's not going to be the Mueller report on Thursday, then something else happens, or, you know, there's some one of these Democratic subpoenas turn up something. If you're going to run a campaign based on that, yes, you're tilting at windmills. Now, is it that he wants to have a debate about the future of the Republican Party and a challenging incumbent president of the United States, especially this incumbent president? will give him an occasional platform to make the case that whether Donald Trump wins or loses this time, whether he's with us for, you know, five more years or one more year, that it's time to have a conversation about what comes next. That's what John Kasich talks about sometimes, too. That's potentially a meaningful enterprise for the future of the Republican Party. It is not. There is zero evidence on the table at this moment that this president can be beaten in a Republican primary. I will say this, though. We've had three successive two-term presidents. George H.W. Bush was the last one-term president. Pat Buchanan didn't beat him, but he ran a primary that bruised the president.
That's right.
And that people from that campaign would tell you had a hangover effect in the general election of turning some people away. Jimmy Carter was the last one-term president before that. Ted Kennedy ran against him, and people around Carter would tell you the primary, not only does it cost time and money, it's distracting, and it could keep somebody home in November. So can Bill Weld convince Republicans who have made peace with Trump, even though they might hold their nose, even though they might be uncomfortable about certain things, you know, they like the tax cuts, they like low unemployment, they like deregulation, so they're going to do it. Can Bill Weld peel some of them off? And would they then vote for whoever the Democrat is? Well, a lot of that depends on who the Democrat is, and a lot of that depends on how persuasive Governor Weld is. So I'm interested to watch if he I knew him when he was U.S. attorney there. That's when I worked for the AP in Boston years ago when he was U.S. attorney. I remember him as a smart enough guy to do math. So I think he understands the math. I'd be interested to see how sort of the how and why as he goes forward.
Does he get any coverage, though, John? I mean, I was going to say if the president is able to exercise self-control, which he never is. But it seems to me the best strategy for Trump is never to talk about Weld. And he's going to sort of disappear considering how many Democrats there are and how much of the political oxygen Trump himself takes. Is CNN, for example, even, I mean, they obviously allowed an announcement, not allowed. There was an announcement made on your air yesterday. Will we even hear about Bill Weld if Donald Trump doesn't attack him?
I think if he qualifies for the ballot, yes, you'll hear from him some. I think he'll get local attention in New Hampshire, which always likes a challenge, which does have an open primary where independents can go and vote in the Republican if they want. So there's more of an opportunity there. The union leader does not have a great relationship with the president of the United States because it actually has a conservative, philosophical, and constitutionally conservative editorial approach, and they think the president runs afoul of that sometimes. So he'll get some. The question of how much will depend on how he does. What is he saying about whether it's policy plans or provocative criticism of the president? Is he saying things that are newsworthy? Is there any evidence he's gaining any traction? Those will be the tests going forward. But you know, I'll bet you a dollar today that the president will see him on TV at some point and not be able to resist giving him a nickname. You know, and we'll see how much. You're right. It would be smart for the president to ignore him. But the president often ignores advice from his own people saying, just ignore this guy. Again, I would not run to Vegas and bet on Weld to knock off President Trump in a Republican primary. But it is possible that, A, he could make some things interesting or at least bring out some debates as we go forward. We'll watch. In the age of Trump, I keep an open mind about everything.
We're talking to John King from CNN.
So, John, apparently there's some upset among some Democrats anyway that aren't fans of Bernie Sanders about his continued momentum and what this could mean for a breaking apart of the Democratic strength going into the end of the primary season.
2016, Marjorie will never die.
Yeah.
That's true.
We'll
That's exactly
die.
Right.
There's a lot of grudges in politics. We focus a lot on the president, who has grievances that he hears every day. There's a lot of this left over in the Democratic primary. And Bernie Sanders, look, I used to call him the PT boat running against the aircraft carrier, right?
Yeah.
Well, the PT boat put a lot of dents in Carrier Clinton in 2016. He kept the race going on, and to the point I just made about a challenge to the president, a lot of Clinton people think the time and money she had to spend dealing with Bernie in the primaries hurt her in the general election. Now, I think there are other reasons she lost to President Trump. We don't need to relitigate that. But Democrats do relitigate these things constantly. And there are a group of people who were aligned with Secretary Clinton or more broadly with the Democratic establishment who don't like him. They think he was harmful to her in 2016. And some of them, it's not just their Clinton bias, if you will, their pro-Clinton bias. Some of it is they do believe that Medicare for All and the Democratic socialism stuff, the fact that he's not even a Democrat, registered as a Democrat, that he's going to lead the party too far left and hurt the party's election prospects. Now, that's for the other candidates to litigate, but there's no question that a subplot, and Bernie's raising money off this, saying the Democratic establishment is out to get me. So it's part of the race. Bernie has all these other opponents. He's, until Joe Biden gets in, Bernie's your front runner. But once Biden gets in, he will be your front runner until he proves he's not. But look, a lot of people underestimated Bernie Sanders in 2016. Fewer people are doing that this time around. Look at the money he raised. Look at his grassroots network. He's in this race for a long time. And so some Democrats don't like that because they don't like him. Some Democrats don't like that because they think he's pulling the party too far left. And we're going to see, as this gets spicy, whether it comes not only from organizations and people affiliated with Hillary Clinton, if and when it starts coming from his other candidates. That, to me, is going to be the interesting point.
You know, I don't mean to bring up the competition, but I thought it was interesting in the town hall, whatever it was, that Fox News had with Bernie Sanders. I think Brett Baer, the reporter, was surprised, maybe I'm wrong, when he asked what people thought in that audience of Bernie Sanders' Medicare for All plan after he asked them how many people had health insurance for their employer, which I think by my look, most of them said they did have insurance from their employer. But they reacted with pretty favorable. They were applauding and cheering, and I didn't expect that from that audience. So that made me wonder.
You make a great point in that Medicare for All can mean different things to different people, number one. The specifics of the plan, if you had a longer conversation where you said, you know, your private insurance will probably disappear, or as Bernie says, you might buy private insurance for plastic surgery and, you know, add-ons, if you will, luxury medical treatment as mm-hmm. opposed to necessary medical treatment, we'd see what would happen. But there's no question Senator Sanders drives a provocative debate about the future of health care. Again, some Democrats who went through the Obamacare experience say, don't disrupt the whole system again. Let's not do that. But give him kudos. Look, you can bring up the competition anytime you want. They're there. I give him credit for that. A lot of Democrats won't even go on Fox, and the Democratic Party won't let Fox have a debate in the Democratic primaries because of what Fox News does in prime time. But Brett's a good guy. He's a solid reporter. There are many good reporters at the Fox News Network. And Bernie gets exposure to an audience that I don't think there's a huge overlap, but you talk about economic nationalism. You talk about helping a lot of Democrats are out there saying Trump didn't mean it. Trump, as Bernie says that Trump, you know, defrauded American workers by saying he was going to fight for them. But on trade and on some of these other issues, there's similarities between Trump and Sanders, and he's smart to try to reach out to those people.
By the way, Marjorie should have finished the story and mentioned that all the people at the Fox News town hall that applauded for Medicare for All, mm-hmm. Sean Hannity had every one of them deported after the, which really was totally inappropriate, but it is. Hey, John, before you go, what's the Democratic Party infrastructure's game plan for Thursday? The Mueller report, redacted as it is, comes out. We know they're going to say we didn't get enough. Is there a game plan for Thursday? Who are the speakers? Who are the players? What, I assume they're crafting a response now. Do you know what's going on that side?
Yeah, and some of this is still in flux because they're trying to figure out exactly what happens. But Congress is in recess, so most of them are not in Washington. My understanding is a couple of key players will come back to Washington, and a couple of the other players will make sure that they are available in a public, you know, your chairman shifts and on the Senate side. Mark Warner, who's the number two, the co-chairman or the vice chairman of the Senate Intelligence Committee, is the top Democrat. Cummings on the Oversight Committee, that they will make themselves available where they are. And the leadership will have people go through it and get talking points to all the other members who are spread around the country, in some cases on international trips, because it is the recess. But you're right. Their expectation is that they believe that Barr is going to redact more than they like, but they'll have to react from there. So they have a plan A in place to be available to comment, to read it as quickly as possible, to get into the public debate. And then I actually think that it's once we see it, I think the conversation late Thursday and early Friday into the weekend is going to tell us, you know, we know this is closing one chapter but opening another. Exactly what that next chapter is, I think we need to see what we get before we know that. But Democrats do expect, number one, a tug of war with Barr first over trying to voluntarily get more information, perhaps in a classified setting, but to get more of it sent up to Congress so they can at least see it, or some of them can see it, the ones who have the clearance. And then the expectation is that some of this will be fought out in the courts. But we're not certain of that yet. That'll be the Thursday night, Friday conversation, I think.
How much agony are you in over the Red Sox start?
A ton.
I figured. I was at the game on Saturday where they got crushed. It was embarrassing. I thought of you about the fifth inning. and figured what pain you must be experiencing.
I've been watching a lot, and they just don't look like they've ever done this before. So hopefully they figure it out.
Keep hope alive, my friend. John King, it's great to talk to you. Thanks.
Hey, thank you very much, John King joins us every week. He's CNN's chief national correspondent and the anchor of Inside Politics, which you can catch weekdays at noon and Sundays at 8 in the morning. Coming up, think twice before you clean your iPhone screen or laptop where you see smudges and grime. Photographer Tabitha Soren sees art. She's next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan live at our GBH studio at the Boston Public Library. And our latest body of work, photographer Tabitha Soren, examines our relationship with technology by taking the smudges, the smears, the fingerprints that cover our iPads and cell phone screens and putting them, literally and figuratively, in a new light. Her solo exhibit is entitled Surface Tension. It's at the Davis Museum at Wellesley. Let me say that again, Jim. The Davis Museum at Wellesley College through June 9th. Tomorrow night at 6, you can catch Tabitha Soren at the Davis Museum, where she'll be discussing her work. It's a pleasure to meet you. Thanks so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Well, as we said before, we're not on the air. Neither are I, Jim and I, are art experts. You did a great interview with Jared Bowen, Open Studio, 8:30 every Friday night. But explain to people that didn't see that. This, to me, is unique and a totally original idea. What are you doing with these photos?
I think the best way to describe it for people who can't see it, since we're on the radio, is if you take your cell phone and hold it into a sharp light from a side angle, all of a sudden you'll notice a whole bunch of markings. And generally what we do immediately, instinctually, is wipe them off on our pants several times a day.
Mm-hmm.
So I let people use my iPad, which is just a larger surface area, and didn't clean it. And enough grime builds up that you have this surface that shows you basically how we're spending our time. And so I was thinking about the fact that people are having less sex, the birth rate has gone down because there's more things to do at 10 o'clock at night than turn to each other. I was thinking about studies that say that a fifth of the country is never offline. Americans, 20% of them never unplug. I was reading short stories like E.M. Forster, The Machine Stops. I mean, this is not a totally current phenomenon, but I do think I'm trying to get at this American moment where we're sort of making our digital lives a priority to our real ones.
So is this an anti-technology thing on your part?
What I like about art instead of the journalism that I used to do is that I don't have to hold back any sort of value judgment, but at the same time, it's a lot more nuanced. So it's not totally anti-technology. I'm posing the question, and I'm having people look at sometimes something much more uncomfortable. Like, for example, there's this landscape that looks like a beautiful painterly Jericho in the Davis. At least it's huge. It's 8 by 5 feet, and it's a blue landscape that's beautiful. But then if you look more closely, you realize it's from Ferguson, Missouri, and it is about really harmful police brutality and civil rights. And if I was just showing people being beaten up, you might not look closely, you might turn the channel, but instead it's a way to pull people in and get people to, in a quiet, safe space of a museum or gallery, just really think about what is happening.
Yeah, when you just heard Tabitha Soren say a minute ago something like, in my prior journalistic whatever, and you say, oh, it's that Tabitha Soren, and it is, of MTV fame and ABC and NBC and all that. How did that transition happen, and why did it happen?
After a couple of presidential campaigns, I was a bit beat and tired, and I spent the 90s running after people or shooting my own stuff. I started as an intern at CNN and then worked for Gabe Pressman at WNBC.
Oh,
and then, I mean, I had my 18th birthday at CNN. So I've been doing it a while, even though I was 29 or so. So I applied for one of those great night fellowships at Stanford.
Oh.
Where you get to take whatever classes you want and sort of just put on, think deeply instead of fast. And I decided I wanted to change gears and approach work from just a more nuanced way. I felt like the more successful that I got, the more mainstream the work needed to become, just as a specific example. So when I was on the Today Show, they hired me because I was a 20-something and they wanted younger people to watch, but the main core of their audience is 60, 70. So my scripts, every story I did had to, you know, diverge, and it just got so watered down because I was trying to appeal to so many different demographics that it became less and less appealing to me because the energy was just sucked out of the story. And the, you know, NBC Nightly News for a 2-minute show, you had 12 people wanting to put their fingerprints on your script. Yeah. And as flattering as it is to work with Tom Brokaw, the end result, I don't know, it just wasn't that interesting.
You have to speak really loudly for that audience, too, I know. So you don't seem to be experiencing any self-doubt. Neither Marjorie nor I have been.
Really?
No, you don't. No, I don't mean in life. I don't know you. But you don't
what do
seem,
you mean?
But do you have any... I mean, you used to have huge audiences.
Oh,
and while
you mean
this,
in the fact here, that I'm downwardly mobile?
Well,
here's
I wouldn't put it that way.
He
but
can't understand why you would go from millions
nobody
of people
can.
To fewer people. This
no,
is a very hard
that's
concept.
That's true.
Because if he had the millions, he would still be there.
Maybe
with,
I would.
At the Today Show, no matter how many people were rewriting his script.
So have you experienced self-doubt about that transition?
No. I feel like I made the right decision. I'm happier making the work I'm making. I like working alone instead of with 20 other people. I'd say the only time I feel... I miss being in the thick of things. You know, if you sit down to a table, I'm not the person people want to sit next to at the dinner anymore. So, you know, but you know, it's a small price to pay.
Tabitha Sorn, as I started to say, neither of us have been to the museum yet, and we are going to get there. But the photographs I've seen of your work and the stuff we both saw on Jared's show, they almost look like paintings.
Yes.
Is that the reaction that most people
yes.
who see this stuff
well,
up close?
Well, I mean, that's a very... I'm conflating digits, the fingerprints on top, and the digital world. I'm also conflating digital photography and the massive amounts of images that we process every day with an analog approach. So the reason they look painterly is because I'm shooting them on an old-fashioned view camera, which everyone has seen Ansel Adams with the black mm-hmm. cape
yep.
over his
yep.
head. So the technology is no different now. So I'm using that. And using a film negative that's literally 8 inches by 10 inches gives you a huge amount of surface area so that I can blow them up to 5 by 8 feet mm-hmm. and not lose any detail or resolution. And I think because of that filter that you're looking through this grime and this bacteria and... you know, all of the sweat. The really glistening painterly ones are the ones that my son has played video games on because he gets so charged that his fingers sweat, and then those that is a different texture than
can you discern the difference between the smudges from one family member
well,
to another?
I think you very much could. So there is a slight surveillance aspect of this if you want it to be serious about it. I mean, I haven't done that myself. I can tell I'm more differentiating by aesthetics than identity, but the fingerprints are about the size of a person's head. Mm-hmm. So if you were interested in figuring out who the source was, you could.
But they're also really varied. When you talk about the Ferguson one, and you've got two wonderful ones of the boys kicking, and then you got this really sexy one.
Well, the sexy one is because it also, one facet of the work is really indexing how Americans spend their time on the internet. And there are two studies that I can give you the facts for afterwards, but one is from England and one is from America, and they both studied how Americans spend the most amount of their time online, and porn is one aspect of that, which not very surprising, right? But the other, what comes in second is cat videos. So you have these two, and you think about it, like, it's very funny at first, right? But it's also very sad because you have these two very intimate acts that are being replaced by this virtual experience when people used to, you know, pet their cat or be with their actual cat, not take videos of it and then post it on YouTube. But the upside is that the scientists also found that if you spend 20 minutes watching cat videos, if you're a cat person, caveat, your serotonin levels go up 20%. So it's not quite as like full of longing and sadness as it might seem.
But you talk about this in the erotic photo, that surface tension is being an erotic title, and the tension between bodies, which I find is a really interesting way to look at this too.
Yeah, I think so. I think that there's a lot of really authentic experience that's very tactile. That's very. I mean, we are oily and sweaty and messy and hairy and the devices. I mean, look at them. They're oleophobic.
They are.
They're perfectly designed. They're shiny. They're oil resistant. They're everything that humanity is not. And so, I guess I'm also trying to point out that some of this messiness is beautiful.
We're talking to Tabitha Sarn. Her exhibit, Surface Tension, is at the Davis Museum at Wellesley through June 9th. Tomorrow night, Tabitha herself will be there speaking at the Davis Museum at 6 o'clock. Is it okay if we discuss one part of your former life that I'm borderline obsessed with?
If I can remember.
Well, you will remember this. I mean, you arguably did the most famous, notable interview with Tupac Shakur.
Are you a big Tupac music fan?
Well, actually, I'll tell you in a second what the connection is. But here is part of this 1995 interview with Tupac. We're asking him about the rape accusations. He just done, 11 months in jail or 10 months or whatever it was. Here is Tabitha and Tupac.
I've grown up with tons of wild stories from lots of legendary rock bands and things that they did with their groupies. Do you feel like there's a double standard for black artists and white artists and how they entertain their groupies?
Yes, it is a double standard because America's scared of a black man's sexuality. And they only see us as brutes who can only go, hammer girl. They just can't imagine us being any other way. And that's why it was so easy for people to believe that I could do this.
It seemed like there was a time, though, that you were definitely reveling in the image of sort of being wild and crazy. And what got you off that path?
5 hot bullets.
Well, tell me what happened at the recording studios in Times Square.
I got shot 5 times. I walked in, some dudes walked in and shot me up, took some jewelry.
Do you know who shot you? No. Is that a no or is that a maybe?
No, I don't know who shot me.
So does that mean that you also have no idea why they shot you?
No, I have no idea why they shot me.
Do you think that they shot you just to get your jewelry?
I don't know. It's like anybody's guess. I don't know.
You know what was haunting about this particularly is you ask him, I don't know what the context was. Maybe it was out of that in that same. I watched it the night that before we had Jared on most recently. I watched it. Is you ask him about dying. And he talks about, no, he didn't worry about dying after being shot because he knows he's going to die a peaceful death. Did you think about that after he was killed? Or?
Yeah, I did. I did. I think that. I think that I don't know, or someone like me could not understand what it is to be someone like Tupac, to have pulled yourself out of a situation where your mother's a Black Panther, but she's also a drug addict. She's, you know, there are these two very strong sides to his background, that one is all about intelligence and social consciousness and social justice, and the other is about, you know, making a name for yourself and going to the Baltimore School of Arts and being in the background of these music videos, and him, you know, being incredibly ambitious. And yet, even with both of those strands, you have this environment that had violence, and you got Suge Knight mixed in there. Anytime you're hanging out with that guy, you got to be, you know, checking over your shoulder all the time. And I think that he only, you know, in that case, I don't know that he was being 100% honest. He surely knew more than he was telling me.
Oh, the look on his face, it was
yes,
clear
well,
he
that's
did. And
where,
you knew it, too.
You know, television is lovely in that sense, because no matter what they're saying, even with politicians, their body language tells you so much more, you know.
Yeah, the reason I'm obsessed with this, Marjorie, is Fanny Shakur, his mother was my paralegal when I was a lawyer in the South Bronx. And little Tupac used to hang out in the office, and he was exactly like you described. He was a quiet, shy, sweet, sweet little boy. And then,
you know, he had Trump's number.
Yeah.
20 years ago, he talked very specifically about how much money does one person need, that this greed undermines everyone, not just people who don't have enough money. It doesn't bring out the best in the people who have the millionaires. And he gave Trump as an example. You know, I think that because there's so much footage of him of, you know, spitting at cameras and going in and out of jail, that you can cut that stuff together and make him look like a really sort of animalistic guy who's, you know, living on the edge. But he had a lot of education, both streetwise as well as, you know, in civil rights, that made him write lyrics that were incredibly moving, very before their time. And he was saying all the things that Black Lives Matter and, you know, a lot of the police brutality stories are talking about now.
You know, the environment, speaking of the environment, just very quickly, Fania, I'm sure you remember this, was part of the Panther 21, who was accused of murder in New Haven. She defended herself as either a late teenager or a 20-something and was acquitted. I mean, it's just, you know, the world in which she grew up was pretty remarkable.
I mean, so imagine if those people had the same, you know, there was an equal playing field for his family, just as an example. I don't mean those people. But, like, it just, people, there's a certain level of stress in a community that saps your energy and your intelligence and your ability to make things happen for yourself and others. And, you know, I just feel like that kind of stuff should be evened out.
It was a great interview. If you've never seen it, you should go to YouTube and check it out.
We're talking with photographer Tabitha Soar, and I did want to ask you before I leave the subject. This was the 1995 interview. How long was this interview done before he was murdered?
I'm almost, you know, I don't know how many decades ago that was, but I think he was, I think maybe 8 months.
So it was
so
shortly.
I think in 96 did he pass away?
So this was only.
Or was killed, rather, I should say.
Talking about taking five hot bullets not long before.
So you don't miss. I mean, this is to go full circle, the first thing I asked you. You don't miss moments like that?
You know, at the time, I felt like I had gotten along really well with somebody I didn't expect to get along with. It's not that I didn't think I would like him. I just thought he would probably care less about talking to me.
He seemed to be totally into it to me.
We had fun. A lot of times people were doing an interview with MTV because they had to, because they needed to get their music videos played. They didn't want to sit down and hang out with me. So I always feel a little strange when people say, oh, you know, well, what was Axl Rose really like? Or what was Bill Clinton really like? Or Arafat? But they were not showing me their real self. They were showing me the self with four cameras around and their publicist and their manager or their press handler or what have you. It's not actually who they are. So when you have, I felt like Tupac, for some of the interview, had a very genuine interaction, and that's worthwhile. But is that not the exception? I mean, you tell me.
Yeah, it's the exception. And it's also very healthy for you to realize that, because I think a lot of people that are in our business think that it is me. And
oh,
not,
really?
Yeah.
Oh, no, I was always very aware.
Yeah, me too, but I think a lot of people are not.
Why do you keep looking at me when you say things like that in this interview, Margaret? I don't quite get this.
I do think that our Americans are brought up to think that if you're on TV, you wouldn't want to do anything else, or radio. And I think that they don't. I think that there are more meaningful things in the world, and the Kardashians and the like, and reality TV and MTV and real life, all that stuff has tricked us into thinking that it's the most satisfying thing in the world.
Well, we can't wait to see your show.
Yeah,
congratulations
on a great body of work in this latest production over at Wellesley. I'm going to tell you where it is in just a second. Oh, that's the intro. Let me go to the next page. We are done, and I just want to tell you that this show is at the Davis Museum through June 9th, tomorrow night at 6. You can catch Tabitha Soren at the Davis Museum. That's where the work is, where she's going to be talking about this. Thank you very much for being here. Davis, by the way, if I didn't say, is at Wellesley College. So thank you for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. You can catch us 24/7 by way of our podcast on iTunes. Thank you for people that came down from the library.
Thank you all. We appreciate it.
Came down to the library. I really appreciate that. Tomorrow we're going to talk to our medical ethicist, Art Kaplan, Jared Bowen, who interviewed you, Bill McKibben, the environmentalist. He's got a new book out. I can't wait to talk to him about that.
It's frightening.
It's
worse than the end of nature.
We need to go to... I think we might have to make a plan to get to Mars. I want to thank Chelsea Murrows, Amanda McGowan, Tori Bedford, Arjun Singh, the WGBH reporter Molly Boygon for pitching in, the people at the Newsfeed Cafe, John the Claw Parker, and Ron Milton, our on-site engineer. What's on TV, Jim?
I don't have time to go through the whole show tonight, but we're going to have a couple of striking workers from the 30,000-plus Stop and Shop strike in New England. They'll be joining me. We'll do politics, too, and a whole bunch of things.
I'm Marjorie Egan.
I am Jim Browning.
Thank you so much for tuning in. Please tune in again tomorrow and have a great afternoon.